moderation in the ministry of Jerusalem.
So we're starting our Saturday presentation with the sheet that says Foreign Policy 1920s and 1930s, comma 1939-45 World War II, where number one says U.S. refuses to cancel World War I European debts, and from there we'll go onward. And this probably will be easy to understand because of the daytime finish of Versailles. So feel free to ask questions and stop me, and I'm just going to kind of strategically move through the things we need to know here. Starting with number one, you recall that the Europeans borrowed money from us for World War I. And when the war was over, did they pay it back?
No.
They did not want to pay it back. They were very reluctant. In fact, their argument was this, and it's a reasonable argument. We lost lives in the war, millions. You lost lives in the war, thousands. So therefore, we all ended up in this conflict together and had to make sacrifices. Wouldn't it be best to say, just write off those debts because we lost so many more millions of people? Well, who are the debts owed to?
U.S. businesses.
Yes, private banks, not the U.S. government, private banks. So is a private banker going to figure that lives are equal to money?
Not according to the Marxist theory.
Not at all. So therefore, they say, in fact, that the quote was, you hired the money, didn't you? You still owe it and pay it back. Which caused Europeans to call Americans Uncle Shylock. What's that a reference to?
Merchant of Venice?
Yes, in the Merchant of Venice, who was Shylock?
A Jewish bank owner.
It's the classic anti-Semitic reference there. A Jewish banker who was not satisfied with not having the money paid back. In fact, he set up the loans so that if you didn't pay back the money, what do you have to pay back in?
Pound of flesh.
Yes. So that's what the Europeans are actually making the equation of, that their pounds of flesh, lost soldiers in World War II, you know, is what's still being demanded by the U.S. bankers by wanting that money back. So there creates some bad feelings between Europe and America, or at least Europe and American banks, is this demand for the debts to be repaid. We will see this when we cover in the 1920s. In the 1920s, there are two important tariffs that take place. One is in 1922 called the Fordney-McCumber Tariff. You see it there, number one. The second one is in 1930 called the Hawley-Smoot Tariff. We'll see that in the mornings. The Hawley-Smoot Tariff of 1930 will be the highest tariff ever passed.
Is that spelled S-M-O-O-T?
S-M-O-O-T, yeah.
What year was the McCumber Tariff?
The Fordney-McCumber Tariff is 1922. Now, while both tariffs are passed in basic Republican philosophy of protect home production by preventing foreign competition, that's not really new. But there was a certain attitude exhibited by the U.S. government in the passage of the Fordney-McCumber Act, and that is, since you Europeans are lackluster to pay back your war European debts, dragging feet and paying some but not all, there's kind of a feeling like, well, let's milk it out of them through a tariff. Feeling that, double resentful, that they have to pay it back at all, that they're being, you know, in a sense, milked through this tariff, Europeans responded by boycotting U.S. farming. And again, I don't know if you've listened to the second set of lectures up there about the populist movement, William Jennings Bryan and all that in the 1890s, which we'll test on in a couple of weeks. But there was, for American farmers, just a little sidestep on a sidestep here, American farmers, after the Civil War, grow in large numbers out west, but because there are so many farmers out west, they overproduce and drive down the prices of crops. And low crop prices is a haunting problem for farmers from the 1870s up to World War I. And it's the basis of the populist political movement. The first time farmers ever get any real gain is in World War I, because they finally got some more markets to sell to, not only Americans, American soldiers, but Europeans, European soldiers, Belgians, etc. All they said make money in the teens. But in the 1920s, when the Europeans boycott American farm products and start buying from Canada and Argentina and elsewhere, in revenge for Fordney-McCumber, which is in revenge for not paying back the debts, when all that happens, America's farmers lose their European markets and go back into having problems. So that's why farmers suffered all the way up to World War I, prospered from World War I up to about 1921, then suffered again throughout the 20s. And then an accurate statement would be is that American farmers in the 20s, are already in a depression. What hits the rest of the nation after 1929 is already hitting farmers in the 20s. So while that may not seem foreign policy related, it is the linkage there between foreign policy and domestic affairs in the 20s. Item two, how were the Allies paying back their war debts? Well, they were milking it out of the Germans. How could they get money from the Germans?
The war reparations.
And that gives us a chance now to talk a little bit about the German government. After the loss of World War I, for the first time ever in German history, what kind of government was established?
A republic
based on democratic principles called the Weimar Republic. That name is in number three. Because it was centered around the city of Weimar. So keep in mind, Germans have only known, I don't call them dictators, but autocrats, whether it's Kaisers or Holy Roman Emperors or kings or whatever, that's all Germany had known. They'd not known a system of free speech and civil liberties, etc. In fact, one of the reasons why, it's an interesting little thing to speculate, is Otto von Bismarck, when he became chancellor in 1871, he figured this out, that if you give the people free education and free health care and many social services, you can deny them free speech and protest rights and press rights, and they'll never care because you'll have bought them off. And it worked quite well. So there was not a system of free speech to protest government action in Germany, because instead they had gone the social services route. So when the Weimar Republic gets started, a lot of German people are skeptical as to whether democracy will work in Germany. And to make sure that it doesn't work very well, the war debts hit. So here's Weimar trying its best to pay off its war debts and make a post-war economy work in Germany. The only way they can do it is to devaluate the mark and inflate their money supply. So that's what's being said here in number three, is the inflation to pay off the war debts by increasing more German money.
So they inflated it?
They inflate their money in order to be able to have more to pay back to the European allies.
I thought that was where it said deflate. I was wondering, how can you pay off stuff by deflating your currency?
By inflating or devaluating. When you devaluate, you inflate. If you deflate, you evaluate. That makes any sense. Well, anyway, the problem is that the German, and you sometimes you see pictures of people going to the markets in Germany in 1923 and 24 with wheelbarrows full of German mark to buy a loaf of bread, and that's how bad things were. So it's the situation is such that the German government is probably going to fall apart, and if it falls apart, it can't pay back its debts to the Allies. And if the Allies don't get the German money, they can't pay back the money to our banks, right? So American bankers cook up a scheme, and that is, why not lend money to Germany to pay the Allies to pay us? That's called the Dawes Plan of 1924, in item 4, put together by banker Charles G. Dawes. You know, Harding died, right? I mean, you just know this from your last life experiences, that President Harding died, right? In office. Some say from just weakened condition, some say poisoned by his wife, but whatever the speculation is. Harding dies in 23, and who is Harding's vice president? Calvin Coolidge. So Coolidge became president in 24. When Coolidge ran for re-election in 24, Dawes was his running mate. That's how successful the Dawes plan was. It took banker Charles Dawes from just being a banker, like it's not much, you know, but it made him a prominent politician and vice presidential candidate and winner.
So they would pay Germany, who would pay?
The Allies.
Like the non-American Allies.
Yeah, the Britain, France people.
Who would then
pay back our banks. So in theory, if it all had worked, by making a second loan arrangement, the first loans will get paid off, and the second ones will be paid off, and the bankers make money twice off of Europe.
Oh, okay.
Had it worked.
And
stock market crash in 29 effed it all up. Fouled it all up. So the stock market crash. This could be the permanent World War II lecture record there. And that's what's meant by this triangle of money flows in number five. In addition to becoming vice president, Dawes also won a Nobel Peace Prize for the action. So he's a Nobel Peace Prize.
Nobel Peace Prize for being greedy.
For helping Germany survive as a republic, to keep a new democracy alive. So he wins a Nobel Peace Prize. He becomes the vice presidential candidate and vice president winner in 1924. And he also, in the middle of all this time, has time to write the jazz song, Take the A Train.
Did he cure cancer, too?
He was working on it. Well, as we see in number six, The It says recession. I should say depression, really. The 1929 stock market crash and corresponding economic bad times worldwide causes Hoover to announce to the Allies, we're going to say for 1 year you don't have to pay us the debts. That's called a moratorium on debts. For 1 year you don't have to pay us. And which the Allies correspondingly told the Germans, for 1 year you can wait. So supposedly they're believing that in 1930 everything will be better and we can go back to the debt payments. And in fact in 1929, not on this sheet, which it should be known, is another American puts together a plan for Germany called the Young Plan. I guess that's his last name. And the Young Plan finally got the Allies to agree that the ceiling of the German debt will be $33 billion. Once they've paid back a total of $33 billion, they've paid back their debt. So, moratorium on payments, Young Plan sets the ceiling at $33 billion. All of it really means nothing, because the Depression doesn't just end in 1 year's time. It deepens into 30 and 31 and 32, etc., and the moratorium becomes permanent. The Allies never pay us back our money. The Germans never pay back their debts. So we've lost twice. The war debts from one don't get paid back, and the war and the Dawes plan money doesn't get paid back.
So
one of the yes.
What is the difference between capitalist, what was it called, reparations, and just tribute to keep us from invading you?
I guess one would turn into the other if it wasn't paid. But I'm glad you put it that way, because that implies that the Allies hold this sword over Germany, that if they don't pay back the war debts, there'll be a resumption of the war, right?
Which would work with the buffer zone.
And in the 30s, that paper tiger starts to be torn apart. And that's where Hitler realizes these former Allies of World War II are no threat to us. We can rearm, rebuild, take our neighbors over, and they're not going to do anything about it. There is no more World War I ally system in place. So they realize they don't have to pay back because they're not going to be invaded.
Did France and Britain know that the United States was lending money?
Oh, yes,
to
that it was all an understood, gee, this is going to work out for everybody plan, they were hoping.
Why didn't we?
Did everyone else realize that if it would have worked out, that we would have gotten paid twice?
You make it sound like making profit is a bad thing. You must be one of them socialists, like me.
Like me.
Another great question that goes into this area. The 1920s is a time period when free market capitalism is really seen as the savior of the world. And there is a belief that not only free market capitalism is the answer to the world, but American free market capitalism will lead the world into permanent prosperity.
And everywhere except the Soviet Union.
Yeah, the Soviet Union is just thumbing its nose at all that. And so in the 30s, when the Depression hits and hits hard, there is such a loss of faith in everything I was just talking about. And there's such an increase of confidence in Russia about the capitalist system seems to be falling like we said it would. So while that's not on our foreign policy thing, it'll help you understand the 20s and 30s, how much the 20s is seen as free market, laissez-faire capitalism is the answer, and how after the stock market crash it just wasn't, which may explain something else. When you think about the New Deal, FDR's New Deal, those who know something about it, what's the big drastic difference between the New Deal and all previous American economic history?
Get the government involved, and the government regulates and pumps money in.
Massive government regulation and redistribution of wealth and spending and taxing going on, things that would have never been believed possible prior to the Depression. How can FDR pull that off? Culturally, how can he convince America to do that?
Because the Constitution is interpreted by the culture at the time.
Well, what was the cultural climate that made it possible for government to be so intrusive, big, in spending there?
Well, everyone's broke and wants the government to step in and fix it.
The failure of the 20s. That's what I'm trying to get across is this is, on the one hand, this belief that more laissez-faire free market 20s is the answer just crumbles with the Depression. So now people are willing to try what they never would before, massive government involvement.
But at the same time, Germany has been massive government involvement the whole time and then switches over.
And fails.
To democracy.
So you can imagine after the failure of the Weimar Republic how easy it is for Hitler to say, remember when Germany was under more autocratic times with government spending, how much better it was? That makes it possible for his movement to do that too. But here's where I want to do 7, but before you look at 7, I want to ask you this. We've made it through together the failure of the League, right?
Yes.
in class. We got to the point where we'll, or we're about to, whatever class you're in, that Wilson's not going to succeed at getting the Versailles Treaty ratified. We're not going to join the League of Nations. And they're not going to pay back their debts. Then in the 1930s, there's the rise of Hitler in Italy and Japan going on. So by late 20s into early 30s, what is the American attitude about why we got into World War One and international activity anyway?
Well, certainly more isolationists, returning back to the pre-World War One.
That's what
Washingtonian thinking.
And add that debt that never got paid, the Allied defaulting debt.
Mm-hmm.
All of that means that the isolationist feeling in America will thicken in the 20s and 30s.
Can they have just repossessed Paris or something?
Repossessed them?
Paris?
Jump over to number 36 on the third page.
36?
Yeah.
Yeah,
let's, this we'll repeat this when we get there, but on item 36, let's do 36 for a second, because I think this is real useful. Isolationism for America deepens and worsens in the 20s and the 30s, and let's go A, B, C through here and see why. First of all, item A, disillusionment with World War One. What's to be disillusioned about World War One? We won.
Yeah,
didn't spread democracy. Didn't make the world safe for democracy. And this is, we're looking at this in the mid-30s. Anybody familiar with what's gone on in the world after 1931, 34, 35, 36,
38?
38? Well, don't write this down, just listen to this. In 31, Japan invaded Manchuria and got away with it. By 37, they'll attack all of China in a major war. In 1935, Italy invades Ethiopia, gets away with it. By 38, we'll invade Albania and get away with it. Germany in 1938 will annex Austria, then move on to Czechoslovakia, then move on to the rest of all of Czechoslovakia, then take Poland by 39. So, and these are the three Axis powers. So when you look at what failed in World War One, and you look at what's going on in the mid-30s, how would Americans, as the 30s unfold, look at World War One?
Well, we screwed things up, didn't we?
Never needed to be in that war. What a waste. What a waste of human lives. What a failed crusade. It would have been probably better off if we just stayed out of the whole mess.
No, and we collapsed our economy.
Yeah, and the debts, as B shows here, the debts never got paid back. So are we going to lend these people money in the future? Hell no.
We'll lend them tanks.
What's it called? Findings.
Pardon?
Non-committee findings.
Now you're getting ahead of me here. You're stealing my punchline.
Sorry.
Hold on. You're the one that goes to the bar and yells out the punchlines right before they get there.
I don't go to bars.
Oh, okay.
I'm not that person all the time.
League failures. Well, we haven't really gone through this, but in each of those occasions I just mentioned, the League of Nations either put up economic sanctions or did nothing to stop these countries. So the League of Nations did not keep the peace, which would make Americans feel which way?
I was not wanting to join.
Yes, good thing we didn't join. This organization is no good.
Good thing we kept hold of isolation.
Of course, is it possible, had we joined and flexed some muscle, that stuff would have been stopped?
Probably not, because
yeah,
you wouldn't have had
political
will at home.
It's,
to
yeah,
that,
it's the old,
if
you'd gone to college, you would have made something of yourself. Well, the fact that I didn't go to college means I don't plan to make something of myself, so quit pushing me. So, yeah, so the U.S. actually, if they didn't have the will to join the league, they wouldn't have had the will to enforce league policy anyway. But it's so easy for us to look back and say, see, Wilson and his dream, how foolish. It would have been better for us just to stay out totally. In addition to that, we move to the Nye Committee and say this. Gerald Nye was a North Dakota senator who in the 1930s began to investigate the question, to what degree was our involvement in World War One truly to make the world safe for democracy or defend ourselves, or was it bankers and munitions makers who want to make profits tricking us into the war? Now, why in the 30s would someone be more and more suspicious of bankers and big business makers?
Because of the sentiment against free market capitalism.
Yeah, the Depression has happened, and there some of these people still have stock and homes and yachts and things, and the rest of the poor people are down and out. So there is a feeling, rightfully or wrongfully, that the Depression was caused by big capitalists, big business capitalists. So is it too far-fetched to assume that the reason we got into World War One was the greed of these merchants of death? That we come to the United States.
That's not too far-fetched.
No, not too far-fetched at all.
Don't you mean these arsenal democracy buildings?
That's what they'll get called in World War II. After we're back in war and need their help, then they're the arsenal. But until then, they're the merchants of death. So that's what the Nye Committee concluded. Now, should be able to kind of put something together here. Nye is from North Dakota, and a lot of his people on this committee who supported this conclusion were from West and from Midwest.
All the German populace there?
They were
always anti-war.
They were anti-war to begin with. They were suspicious that World War I was this to start with. They always felt like the merchants and bankers were
trading. What they wanted to.
Yeah. So by the 30s, it was much easier to see during the depths of the Depression that we probably got dragged in unnecessarily. There's going to be some follow-up to that, but first let's do C and D. What do we know to be true about Washington's farewell address? His warning was never join permanent alliances with Europe anyway. So, in a sense, we joined a little temporary alliance in World War I, didn't we? I mean, it wasn't a formal alliance, but it was a temporary cooperative action.
And the League of Nations would have been a permanent alliance.
That would have been a real permanent alliance. So by
the
not
UNN.
So what I'm getting at is there is a resumption or a return of Washingtonian isolation in the 30s, built not just around Washington's good advice, but built around experiences of the 20s and 30s, that it was Washington was right, we should stay out of this. And then of course D is very obvious, that during an economic depression, people just don't have time or commitment to worry or care about foreign policy. It can kind of be compared to the space race. Space race was big stuff in the 50s and 60s. Get to the moon in a decade before the Russians do. What was the big...
You had that onion paper?
Yes. Just as he said it, I thought of it. What in 1957 made us suddenly space race-minded?
Leaping 2 foot in ball.
The Russians surprised us by putting a satellite into space before we could. The Russians! These peasant Slavic people from the steppe putting things into... I don't believe that. That's what they believe. But putting things into space faster than we, the Americans, could.
It was like 50, right?
1957. 57. Somehow their captured German scientists outdid our captured German scientists.
Well, not really. The Soviet Union just never got off the right foot on bombers, so they switched to working on missiles before the U.S. did.
Ooh. But the point being is, and we're jumping way out of time here, that the Sputnik of 1957 shocked us into, if we fall behind the Russians in the space program, we're going to be in real danger. So we need to get caught up and start spending more money on science and research. And some of those wooden desks sitting in Hyatt's room were probably purchased in 1958 from Sputnik money.
I think that one's in there too. Pentagon develops atomic bomb-proof desks.
Yeah. So I don't know how I got off on this tangent, but you do because you thought of the same thing I did. Why am I on this tangent? What parallel am I making?
What? Huh? Why are we off on this tangent?
The economic depression.
Yeah.
No one cares about foreign policy.
That's it. Thank you. Thank you for bringing me back. So in the 50s and 60s, we were very concerned about the space race. This floor is cool.
Like jump right into the Cold War.
Yeah, and we cared a lot about spending a lot of money on getting to the moon. But after we got to the moon in the early 70s, and by the late 70s for sure,
no one cares at all.
Why did the space race nearly freeze up?
Well, because people stopped caring, and they just... Oh, and the Soviet Union.
People were like, that's cool, now let's go back to, stuff happening on the planet.
Vietnam and economic problems of the 70s. When we got preoccupied with other problems at home, there just wasn't the money or the will to spend money on the space race anymore. And as we got friendlier and detente with the Russians, there didn't seem to be as much fear of being, as we were so far ahead of them anyway. So spending on the space race caused us to, spending on domestic issues and economic hard times in Vietnam, we lost the will to follow into space. Similarly speaking, I think economic depression in the 30s diverted our attention away from foreign policy.
Except they don't really deficit
script.
Spending in
yeah.
the 30s.
We'd had these plans like the open door policy to protect China, and we had Roosevelt correlated to defend Latin America. We were active in foreign policy, but not in the 30s, because you can't be fighting the Depression and being an internationalist at the same time. We didn't think we could. So we lost enthusiasm in the 1930s to be involved in foreign policy, which means we're not looking at Hitler and the Italians and the Japanese taking over foreign countries. So this is a bit of a jump away from where we started. But what's the theme I'm trying to build here?
When we have really dire domestic situations.
And we're disillusioned about being tricked into World War I.
Yeah.
We go back into our
Not really dire, because I wouldn't consider the space race something dire.
Yeah.
But and we have anything, any kind of domestic issues that preoccupy us with.
Unless Pearl Harbor's happening that day, we're not too involved in foreign policy.
We don't care about the rest of the world.
That's kind of true. And the Nye Committee also, in fact, let's jump a little bit from 36B to 37. Following the Nye Committee's conclusions, Congress passed from 1935 to 1937 what were called the Neutrality Acts. And the Neutrality Acts essentially contained these aspects. It's illegal to lend money to nations at war. We'll call nations at war belligerents so I can use less words. So illegal to lend money to belligerents. Second, illegal to travel on the ships of belligerents.
Lusitania.
Right, well, just like the Lusitania. Exactly. And it's illegal to sell weapons to belligerents.
Yeah, that lend-lease doesn't kind of fall under their labor.
That's arsenal democracy stuff. And then there, and it's illegal to sell non-weapons on credit.
So
if you're selling
rain,
like Ouija boards and potato salad and things like that, they can't buy it on credit. They got to pay for it.
That vile container ship full of Ouija boards.
That's right.
I think China sells them.
Why would why would the laws target those things as illegal?
Because that
got us into World War One.
Because those things dragged us into World War One. Lending money, selling weapons, traveling on ships, those are the things with German submarines out there.
How do they buy the weapons on credit?
They can't default on their loan if you didn't give them a loan.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
So there's not going to be any bitter connection of expectation coming. So the 30s, the late 20s and early 30s are a time where America lapses back into very severe isolationist neutralism, non-involvement in the world. I guess the oddity to all this is what's going on in the world, or at least in Europe and in China, in 1935 onward.
In where?
The Europe and China.
Well, China.
China.
Ethiopia,
Japan,
Albania, Austria, China.
They're all getting invaded by the Axis.
Who are the Axis people? Let's name these people.
Germany, Italy, Japan. And Japan.
You mean it's not Iraq and North Korea?
That's later.
Okay. Why did I just make that reference?
It's about number
two. We call them the
There's a Saturday Night Live skit. And it's supposed to be President Bush, and he makes this thing, he calls the Axis of Evil.
That's not
and he names off like North Korea and it's a Middle Eastern country.
That actually happened.
That's a real life thing, man.
But the way he does it is really funny.
You mean like he believes it?
And yeah, he's like, I don't like Cheney because he just kind of wanders around and I don't see him very often. So he's on the axis of evil. And adding all these, like, math is on the axis of evil because I don't like
Hey,
numbers.
Let's work on that skit. Where does this axis of evil phrase get started? Anybody remember?
Wasn't it a State of the Union address in 01?
02.
Oh, 02?
Yeah. He just kind of took office in 01. So In the 02 State of...
He didn't screw up until 02.
The 2002 State of the Union address...
Oh, okay.
David Frum, I believe, is the speechwriter, put into his speech, call North Korea, Iraq, and Iran the axis of evil. And before we explain why he did that, what does this axis word bring back to us?
The axis power.
The real axis. Who were the real axis?
Germany, Italy, and Japan.
And they organized in the mid-30s. In fact, in 1936, Mussolini said to Hitler, in the future, people will draw a line from the capital, Rome, to Berlin, and around those two capitals, around that axis, the whole world will someday rotate. That was Mussolini's way of trying to say, Italians are as important as Germans, and the two of us are taking over this world.
Did you see the Onion article? It says, Venezuela demands Axis of Evil membership.
Hugo Chavez. And Japan gets added to this Axis power thing around 1937, 39, the Tripartite Pact of 39. So those are the three nations that we just mentioned were gobbling up their neighbors in the late 30s. Were they a major threat to world peace?
Probably.
When you consider all of World War II and what we went through, were they a major threat?
Yeah.
Were they only a major threat after December 7, 41, or were they a threat back in the 30s?
Rather threats before that, but not really to us as much.
Okay. getting ready to make a parallel here.
Well, we assume they weren't a threat to us. There's kind of the possibility that Japan could have.
We weren't listening.
Having the hindsight we have now, we know that these powers that started World War II were probably the biggest threat to world security ever, in terms of the whole world. So why didn't we see that in the 30s?
Because of all these four things that we did.
And that's why I think it would be a great DBQ.
We're still in our shell.
Would that be a great essay question?
Yeah.
Why was the U.S. unable or unwilling to see what was coming? Because the hardened isolationism of the 20s had us not focused on it. The disillusionment of World War I, the preoccupation of the Depression, the traditional isolationism of Washington, the fear that we're getting dragged into another conflict by merchants of death, capitalists, all that made us unwilling to see. But as it turns out, when we were shocked by Pearl Harbor in 41, we came to realize with no choice, we have to fight the Axis, and gosh, sure would have been nice if we'd been on the ball sooner. Here's the parallel I'm going to make. Why is that North Korea, Iraq, Iran aspects given into his speech in 2002?
Because it's designed to spin it in a way where your opinion is just against them based on the past.
Yeah. Bush was trying to make Americans fear that Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, especially with the possibility of nukes, and all three were accused of at some point in time building or having, and still are being accused, or they are, possessing weapons of mass destruction, that they constitute the same threat to the peace of the world in the 2000s as did the Axis in the 30s, but Americans are acting as isolationists now as they are in the 30s. It's the surrender monkey Democrats that don't want to go into this conflict and protect us. Yes. They don't want to protect us against it's a war on terror.
So 9/11 can be
9/11 is Pearl Harbor, and people can wake up to 9/11 is Pearl Harbor, or otherwise we'll be deeply alone on our own against the terrorists worldwide, of which these three nations seem to be the greatest sponsors of.
Except wasn't World War II over in this many years?
Well, maybe if we had a little more commitment on the Democrats' part to get with the surge. So, do you think the parallel is apt? Well, that's your personal opinion. I don't. I think it's a miscomparison.
I think that they're sensationalizing.
I don't think Iran, Iraq, or North Korea ever got together and signed Axis agreements or tripartite pacts or made plans or shared weapons. Scheme to take over the world. I don't think that's true.
Well, they all bought their weapons the same place.
Russia?
Yeah.
Supposed to be our friend. Yeah. I just don't see the parallel, and I don't think that they have those kind of ambitions, nor do they have the power to do so. Now, I could be wrong. I could end up being like a 1930s isolationist, but that's why, if I'm right, why is Bush making that parallel?
Because he's wrong.
There's a lot of people.
He could believe what he believes.
Try to convince the people that, like, they're thinking like he did.
Demagoguery.
Well, it's a demagoguery to get people onto his war on terror.
There's a lot of people without these sheets who don't know things.
Well, and in fact, what do for a while, they haven't said it recently, but Rumsfeld and Cheney got into a habit of calling, they're not just Islamists, they're what?
Islamofascists.
Islamofascists, make that parallel. Back to the Axis.
I think O'Reilly adopted that from them.
Yeah, so that's...
Yeah.
That's not necessarily on the AP test, but it gives you some perspective of where we're at now as a society and how the understanding of World War II is critical to understand where they're going with this.
I'll be on the AP test.
Okay.
It's too recent, I think, to be on the AP test, but World War II is not.
Well, they could ask to draw parallels.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how recent, like what's the most recent thing?
The essays have never gone beyond the most recent essay asked the civil rights in the mid-60s. They claim they won't ask an essay past 75.
So they're just ignoring the entire not being able to get regional pay in Congress?
Well, it's too hard. The less they ask, the better advantage it is. You want to learn more, but you want to pass more, too. So let's be happy with 75 limit there. But that means they could go up to Watergate and Vietnam. They haven't. They traditionally keep their essays really before the 60s. That rarely do they have. The only ones I've ever seen, the only two essays I've ever seen in the 60s were a civil rights essay and a hippie culture essay. And outside of that, they haven't gone past the 60s.
Well, before you came to Quiz,
multiple
the other
choice
day,
stuff.
They asked Woodstock.
Did they really? Multiple choice traditionally doesn't go up past about 70 either, but every once in a while they'll pepper in a few questions in the 80s and 90s. They'll ask about Carter foreign policy or even Bush and Clinton. And some Reagan stuff. But I'll try to emphasize that. Well, so I've jumped ahead, but there's a purpose here. The themes I'm trying to build is America's post-World War I experience in the 20s and 30s is one of elapsing back into isolationism and doing so with a sense of bitterness. We won't be tricked again. And because we are in that firm, head-in-the-sand isolation status of the 30s, we refuse to see the Axis as a real threat until Pearl Harbor. Now back to sheet one. Okay, we're on number 8. I think I can explain. You don't have to write 8 down. Just look at it and feel what I'm saying here. Okay, who thought of the League of Nations? Who didn't join? So Americans to dream it up, push the Europeans to create it, and then we don't join. What was the purpose of the League of Nations?
To end all wars.
Yeah, to end wars. To reduce weapon threats, to make people work together, all through dialogue and cooperation. And here we are not participating, not doing it. How do some Americans feel about that?
I don't feel because we created it.
That's what they're saying. There is a certain degree of guilt over talking tough through the 14 points about world organizations and peace and then not having the anatomy to support it. So Americans kind of want to do whatever they can to show Europeans, hey, we're for peace, we're for collective security, we're just not for being in the League. And that's the reason that number 9 occurs. In an effort to show that we are for arms reductions and collective security, there is a proposed Washington Naval Conference of 1922. 3 treaties will come out of this conference, 5-power, 4-power, and 9-power treaty. Now, before we go into these treaties at all, let's spend a little time on something called the open door policy, which you probably already know thoroughly from listening to those things, but we'll run the risk of you hearing it twice. Anybody at all familiar with the open door policy?
A little. What did you say?
Open door policy. So you're not writing, you're just listening. Yeah. Okay. It was first enunciated by John Hay, Secretary of State for McKinley, the one who also called the Spanish-American War a splendid little war. It was continued on into the Roosevelt administration. The open door policy was this. As Americans watched Europeans in Japan and Russia gobble up portions of China, this is 1898, 1899, turn of the century, spheres of influence, colonies, as the Europeans carved up and took more and more control over Chinese provinces and areas, the American attitude was, pretty soon there'll be nothing left to make money from. The markets will all be gone. So Hay sent around a series of letters to the European leaders saying, we demand you keep the door to China open. Do not gobble up China. These open door notes became the basis for the so-called open door policy.
Just leave China alone?
Leave China as one piece. One of the great, great threats that came right after that to the open door policy was the Boxer Uprising. Have you heard of that?
Is that how they...
A bunch of Chinese...
Isn't it usually students?
Secret society xenophobic terrorists, freedom fighters, rose up against the West. They believed that these Westerners were carving up their country and spreading Christianity, and they were. And so these Chinese secret society people wanted to rescue China culturally from the West. And they tried to take over all the diplomats hostage in Peking in 1900. International troops invaded, rescued their diplomats, but now had control of China. Second round of open door notes came from John Hay saying, still, we warn, don't carve up China. And we ran on the international force, too. We sent some of our soldiers in to rescue our diplomats. Either competition or the American threats, whichever, worked, and China was not carved up, but a financial indemnity was paid. From 1900 up to 1920, our negotiations with Japan continue to be all built around don't carve up China. You can carve up Korea, you can take Formosa, you can take part of the Sakhalin Island, you can take all these other things.
Manchuria.
Parts of Manchuria, you can have some influence, but you're not going to carve up China. So most of American foreign policy from 1900 to 1920 is built around keep everybody who's threatening China, and it's mainly Japan now, from carving up China. That's the open door policy. These three treaties, on the surface, are put together to try to create collective security and peace and disarmament, But they are tied to, how do we find a way to maintain the open door policy? So if you'll understand that when we go through it, you'll be fine. The first treaty, the Five-Power Treaty, established a limit on ship tonnage with the following ratio, 1.67 to 1.67, and that ratio goes with these nations, Britain, U.S., Japan, France, and Italy. So what we mean is, for every 5 tons, for every 5,000 tons, for every 5 million tons of shipping the British have, the Americans can also have 5, the Japanese can have 3, and the French and the Italians can have 1.67.
This is going into China or coming out?
I'm lost by the question.
I think I misunderstood
what
you said.
What these 5 nations agreed to was they will limit their military ship tonnage.
The amount of ships that they have.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Maybe the way to look at it is this way. Today, what is our first line of defense? If we were really invaded, what would we use? Nukes. We'd use nukes.
On Antwerp?
Oh.
He said we were invaded.
Once they start across the Azores, we'd nuke them. Well before they get anywhere close to our shores.
Are you talking about ships, plants, or what?
Make it simpler. What's the most powerful stuff we have
to use? Are you talking about salt too?
I will be. In World War II, what was the most powerful stuff we had to use?
Firebombing?
Bombers. Bomber planes. In World War I, what was the most powerful stuff nations had to use?
Ships.
That's what I'm saying. So when you limit ship tonnage in this, you're like limiting your nukes now. That's what it meant in 1922. That's
so
pretty
serious. That's a big deal.
That's a big deal. That's serious trust.
How did they agree to let Britain and U.S. have...
Well, now hold on. Before you look at the tilted numbers, let me say this. To get to this ratio, Britain and the U.S. had to destroy ships. We had so much more than the limit.
That we weren't doing stuff that Bikini had told to get rid of them.
Yeah. Well, we kind of were. This is Billy Mitchell's story. We had to reduce our ship tonnage to fit the ratio. And we allowed Japan to build up. To get to 3, Japan was allowed to build more. To get to 5, Britain and the U.S. had to reduce.
Wow. You know about Italy and France?
I don't know what's...
I bet the measures check out with the French too.
But knowing the way history turned out, but knowing the history at the time, what's the ramifications of these numbers?
Japan has the forces it needs to take over their entire code prosperity sphere, or whatever it's called.
With 3?
Yeah, with 3.
Well, wouldn't at first glance, if the Anglo and the Americans work together, that's a 10-3 ratio?
Yeah, but
France and Italy work together, then that's...
This is 1922. Germany's trying to pay off its
war
debt. You're jumping. I'm going to jump up there, too. But in 1922...
It means that Japan has ships near China.
And probably a few more.
But the Anglos have enough to defeat them if they need to.
And if Japan actually tries to use their increased 3 to take over China, they're going to be going against what policy?
The open door policy.
So why was Japan allowed to build up?
So they'd be happy.
So they'd be happy. Remember the complaints with the Versailles Treaty? Japan wanted to be treated as a world equal.
That was, they took away their demands for that.
Mm-hmm. So the point being here is, if we let Japan be treated like an honorary Aryan, which is a Hitler phrase, if we let Japan be seen as more of a world power, they will feel grateful and respectful towards the West. But if they ever get really uppity and become the real yellow peril, it's a 10-3 ratio, we can take them.
So I have a question.
Or we could take them if we had the will to take them, which we lose in the 30s.
So to keep a country from invading another country, you buy them off with weapons?
Appeasement?
By giving them weapons with
which we don't want them to put their own weapons on the boats.
Well, I think yes, in the sense that if you treat somebody else with a certain degree of respect, yes, you are now considered our equal, so be a responsible world power like we are.
And don't take over China, just take over Vietnam and Korea.
Well, it didn't work. I'm saying it didn't work. But that was the theory behind it. And we were able to now say, we have engaged in reduction of arms, we've engaged in limitations, we've shown respect to Japan, and we got the open door policy hopefully covered because they're going to show respect to us by not invading China. And we got it all done without ever joining the League of Nations, aren't we, Slick?
At this point, Italy is not evil yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's the same year Mussolini will take over, 22.
Everybody, I did miss when I said evil.
They're not fascist yet. Well, they are. They've just turned fascist. But we don't know what that means. In fact, in the early days of Mussolini taking over, Italy was in just such a horrible mess, the trains were 2 and 3 hours late. Oh, yeah. I told the story already.
Yeah, the train.
They finally ran on time. Of course, they were conductors were shot if they didn't run on time. So the expression, to get the trains run on time, has multiple meanings to it. But the next two, and I'm going to go into great detail, but the four power and nine power agreements, and those four powers are four of the five nations, and the nine power, those five plus four more that I don't know. But the four power and nine power agreements essentially said everybody will respect everybody's territorial claims as they currently exist. So let's talk a little bit about the Pacific for a second. What are our territorial claims in the Pacific by 1922?
The Philippines,
Guam, and Hawaii. And where did we get the Philippines, Guam, and Wake?
Spain.
In the Spanish-American War and the Paris Peace Treaty of 1898 that you listened to up there, right? So that's where we got those things. So we want Japan to respect those things. And what does Japan have by this time period, by 1922?
Manchuria?
They have interests, but not in presence in Manchuria.
Korea.
They have taken over Korea. They've taken over Taiwan. So we're going to respect that. But if we respect what Japan has, and Britain, by the way, has what?
Everything else.
Hong Kong, Australia, New Zealand, and the Holland or the Dutch have the East Indies. So the point being, hey, Japan, the Europeans have colonies, you have colonies, we all have colonies, nobody's going to take each other's colonies, and the door to China remains open. So that's the theory behind the nine power and four power treaty.
Why do we, like, what's the whole entire point in keeping China open?
Money.
Selling stuff.
But
they have to be allowed to sell stuff.
You ask a question like that?
But why China?
Because there was so much profit coming from the China market.
Okay.
The sale to China was probably greater than to Latin America and close to that of Europe.
So, okay.
That's how much money was being.
Sorry, I was just a little bit behind. I got it.
Always think, you know, suspicious of the capitalists, and you have my lecture figured out. Joke, little joke there. But anyway, yeah, it's a China market is that important.
Okay.
And I guess what a theme I'm building here is, despite the financial importance of trading to China, we find the isolationism of the 30s causes us to lose our will to protect the open door policy. Because as Japan starts to gobble up China in the 30s, we don't do anything about it. We send the signal to Japan, okay, the open door is dead, do what you will.
And they'll cut off the oil later.
And then they'll hit Pearl Harbor and we will reverse ourselves. Okay. Hold 10. Don't look at 10. 10 will confuse us unless we come down to 11 first. And in fact, at the end of number 9, there is another naval conference held in London in 1930, which was supposed to address limitations on ship tonnage for smaller ships. It never happened. Let's do 11. In 1928, this is a fun little piece of story here. In 1928, Aristide Briand, the French foreign minister, comes to America wanting to have a meeting with our Secretary of State, Frank Kellogg.
So the foreign minister is the same thing, basically, as our
Secretary of State? Foreign minister is like our Secretary of State. So Aristide Briand comes to America to meet with Frank Kellogg. And he offers Frank Kellogg the opportunity to join a peace alliance. Not a defense alliance, but a peace alliance.
Not a what alliance?
Not a defense alliance, but a peace alliance. And this peace alliance is built around the belief that or the faith that America and France will never declare war on each other. They will keep the peace with each other. That sounds kind of nice, doesn't it?
Kind of random.
Why would we want to be reluctant to join in?
Why would we want?
Why would we be reluctant to join in? I mean,
because it's an entanglement?
It's an entanglement, yes it is, but it's not a war entanglement. It's a peace entanglement.
Why would they come and say
we're still the solution to
over they're about to screw up majorly and piss
us
all off?
Turn it on its head, what does it mean?
It means France
we
can
do whatever
over.
We
France is going to invade someone.
We can do what we want.
And we will be obligated to be their ally.
Exactly.
Just like we won't go to war with each other, we'll defend each other if we're attacked.
But it doesn't mean, if it doesn't matter that we don't have a defense pact, the other person sees an alliance and they attack us anyway.
Well, I think the expectations are is that if we joined into this thing, then we'd be obligated to be each other's friends if in trouble. That was, it was just Briand's way. Knowing America's reluctance to join alliances, and knowing how guilty we felt after not being in the league, maybe something like this is just exactly the thing that can, through our guilt, smooth us into joining. And then we'll be obligated into protecting France the next time the Germans invade. That's the real purpose. And Kellogg saw this. And what's it going to look like in the news if the U.S. refuses to join in peace alliance? You know, CRUDs who won't join League of Nations also won't join peace alliance.
It's like, are you pro-death?
Yeah. So Kellogg says there's a way around this. The way to get away from the bad press is going to follow this. He goes back to Briand and says, you know, it's such an excellent idea that it shouldn't be confined to just two nations. We need everybody to join the peace alliance. It's kind of like you don't want to say no to the date, so you bring all your friends on the date, and it's no longer a date. So he invited 62 other nations to join up. And they did. 62 nations signed the Kellogg-Briand Pact, renouncing war as an instrument of foreign policy.
That's a joke.
Every major power of World
Germany
War II,
yeah.
Every major power that was in World War II signed the Kellogg-Briand Pact, renouncing war as an instrument of foreign policy. And somewhere in the cynicism, Kellogg moved from, boy, did I rescue America from embarrassment, to, maybe this will work. Maybe we've done it. Maybe by signing this pact, all the nations of the world will not use war. And by reducing ship tonnage, they won't have the weapons. We're 14-pointing all the way without joining the league. We're making it happen.
For the next 10 years, anyway.
So what's happened here?
We've sort of just done that whole idealist thing that Wilson was.
We've kind of tripped into the idealism that we can make it work through agreements without weapons and armaments, starting from a cynical, you know, avoiding responsibility point to thinking we can do it this easier way.
Yeah, but if there's no way to enforce it, don't you just create a false sense of security leading up to World War II?
Yes. And also, how about this? We know that when World War II breaks out, the powers that signed this pact and agreed to limit their ship tonnage were the enemies that started the war. If we had been armed to the teeth and kept their weapons smaller and never trusted them in a peace alliance, ready to move the first time they were aggressive, would World War II have been so bad?
No, it would have just been like Iraqi freedom before the mission accomplished.
So now here's the parallel I want to make. As we get out of World War II, and our allies, the Russians, who were never really good friends anyway because they were commies, start to frighten us in Eastern Europe, and so we start to build more A-bombs, and they do too, then H-bombs, and they do too. When people in the late 50s and early 60s say, we should negotiate with the Russians, we should reduce armaments to prevent a major world war, how are those people perceived?
They get to go before the Committee on Un-American Activities.
Mm-hmm. So those people who call for reductions of arms against the Russians in the Cold War, they say, didn't you learn anything from the failure of Kellogg-Briand, the failure of the Washington Naval Conference, that World War II happened anyway? Which makes it extremely difficult to talk about arms limitations during the Cold War without looking like you're the fool of the 20s. And yet, oddly enough, we finally will agree to limit and eventually agree to reduce. In 1987, finally we agree to reduce weapons with the Russians. And who's the one that's willing to lead us into it?
Reagan.
Ronald Reagan, who called the Soviets the evil empire.
And said that they were illegal.
And may have passed legislation down one.
Yeah. I mean, Reagan, who in his early career, like Nixon, built his whole career on fear the Soviets, be armed to the teeth against the Soviet threat, eventually, like Nixon, becomes famous at the end of their hard times by negotiating with the communists.
That works out. Eventually, the Soviets built so many missiles that they bankrupt themselves.
Now, I know this will resonate with no one now, but someday in your future years, when you're old and gray, you'll watch a rerun of a Star Trek movie and get it. Do you remember this, unless you're Star Trek fans now, did you see the one where Kirk negotiates with Gorchoff, or whatever his name was, of the Klingons?
That's kind of Reagan Gorbachev.
Kirk meets with the Klingons and for the first time starts to put a freeze to the Cold War between the Federation and the Klingons. Didn't see that movie.
See that movie, but can understand that.
Kirk doesn't want to do
it.
Kirk hates the Klingons because the Klingons killed his kid. And he will never negotiate with Klingons. But he's finally talked into doing it by Spock. And Spock says this to Kirk. Only Nixon could go to China.
Nice.
So now you got the reference there.
And remove recognition of Taiwan.
So we are on 12. 12 through about 16, has to do with Latin America, foreign affairs in Latin America. To understand that, we have to flash back to our previous Latin American policy, which is online, but may not listen to yet. Take some quickies here.
You can summarize it as the U.S. is the only country allowed to screw over Latin America.
That's going to be the thesis, but people believe theses more when there's proof, so I'm going to give some evidence. Spanish-American War was fought in 1898 for what purpose?
The U.S.S. Maine.
Liberate Cubans from Spanish tyranny.
Torture.
And Spanish torture. Now, there was also some desire for sugarcane profits and greater control over that area. Build a naval base to protect a future canal, which we still have today, Guantanamo Bay. But it's fair to say that more than 50% of our involvement in the Spanish-American War is freeing Cubans, more than it is personal greed. But following the freeing of Cuba, we passed something in 1901 called the Platt Amendment. You ever heard of this?
Barely. Vaguely.
The Platt Amendment, again, you're not writing, you're just listening and enjoying.
I was writing.
The Platt Amendment says, Cuba's free, but, we can protect it, we can provide defense for Cuba. Second, that's always kind of iffy when someone says they're going to defend you. What's that mean? Second?
That means they reserve the right to keep troops in Europe.
That's right, right. Cuba cannot borrow money from European banks, default on the loans, get themselves invaded, and have to come bail them out. Which means if Cuba wants to borrow money from some foreign source, it better be SAR banks, yes.
So we can
now, that is, and the third provision of that Platt Amendment was we have the right to build a naval base, which we did and it's still there today. So here we liberate Cuba in the Spanish-American War, but then just in 1901, 3 years later, we say, you're a free country, but here's these strings attached. The second part is not as awkward as I made it sound. A number of nations between 1900 and 1904 in Central and South America were borrowing money from European banks, not paying back the loans, and making the Europeans angry. And there was some serious thought on the parts of the Europeans of mounting their navies and invading Latin America to collect their debts.
Which would be
Monroe Doctrine.
Monroe Doctrine.
Yes. And that was the Roosevelt. That just feels anti-Monroe, doesn't it?
Well, that was the Roosevelt, whatever it's called.
That's where I'm going with this, yeah.
How it makes Americans angry, too.
Because they may come in to collect debts and never leave.
Oh, and then it's like the Americans are the police for the Western Hemisphere.
That's where I'm going with this.
The Roosevelt Corollary.
Yeah. Do we already know all this?
You lectured
in
past. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's for both classes or just third?
Second.
I got it in third.
So that's where I'm going with this. The Roosevelt Corollary is built around the idea that if these Europeans try to invade and collect money, it's going to violate the spirit of the Monroe Doctrine. So Theodore Roosevelt in 1904 says, you can't come in. If anybody is going to settle this, it's the U.S. And one vivid example is in the Dominican Republic. In 1903, we take over the Dominican Republic and take in tax dollars, pay back the Europeans, give them the rest, and leave. So we saved the Dominican Republic from being invaded, right?
By invading it ourselves.
How did the Latin Americans see our Theodore Roosevelt Corollary?
We invaded the Dominican Republic.
Yankee imperialists. So even though we think we're protecting the hemisphere from Europe, we look like we're the big Yankee imperialists from the north.
So they saw America under Roosevelt like America under Wilson actually was?
You're going to get there. By 1909, we take an even further intrusive step into Latin America. During the Taft years, we issue something called dollar diplomacy. Dollar diplomacy means this. Our foreign policy in Latin America, its first purpose is profits, protecting investments. So, for example, let's say we own a copper mine in Chile.
Or in Cuba.
Yeah, and we're making money hand over fist out of this mine, but the Chileans who are working the mines are working for starvation wages, and here they're watching their natural resources leave to America to make Americans rich, and they're just barely getting by with subsistence income. What might they feel about their copper mine?
That they should nationalize it?
Yeah, and kick out the Yankee imperialists who are making money. So or a banana plantation might undergo the same situation. So according to dollar diplomacy, what do we do in the face of that?
Say, screw them, we want our money.
Well, the first thing you can do is try to get the local ruler to crack down on these people.
By buying them off.
You can buy them off, you can give them weapons, etc. What if he just can't keep the peace?
Then you have to go there.
Send some troops to help him out. What if they overthrow and kill him? Then you just take over the country and run it. And that happened. That's what dollar diplomacy entailed, all the steps I just mentioned.
Which country?
Nicaragua, Dominican Republic.
We didn't invade Cuba, but they took over
El Salvador. It's about 5-6 different nations. Mexico for a short period of time. So our policy of Latin America from 1909 on into the early 1920s is our first concern is making profits regardless of your governments are mistreating you. If you're being mistreated by dictators, as long as we're making money, we're okay. Am I sounding too hate America leftist here?
Not really. It's realistic.
Because it was really what was going on. So, with the Platt Amendment and with dollar diplomacy, and also the Panama Canal story, there's an interesting one there. Colombia wouldn't accept our offer, so we foment a revolution in Panama and just break a country away and negotiate a new treaty with them within 20 minutes. And Panama is an independent country with our canal being built in it.
Wait, in 20 minutes?
So it was rolling a day.
Yeah.
The American way.
So the way we got the Panama Canal,
like Roosevelt
corollary, all three things, yes, we're making profit in Latin America, but we're also engendering some real bad will going on down there.
But isn't that introduction like we don't care, basically?
Well, we're going to fix that. That introduction, we moved to 12. In the 20s and 30s. In the 20s and 30s, we make a serious effort to patch up the bad relations with Latin America. And I think I'm going to not say why until after I've done 13 and 14, and then come back and look at 12. Our first action to do this comes in number 13. In December of 1928, we renounce the Roosevelt Corollary.
Renounced?
Yeah, which means we are no longer going to be the policeman that comes into your country with the alacrity not to solve problems. We're going to respect your local governments have the sovereignty of your nation. We're not going to be doing that anymore. That's the Clark Memorandum of 1928. Clark, an Undersecretary of State for Stimson in the Hoover years. Then in 1933, when FDR first takes office, he sends Cordell Hull as Prime Minister to a Pan-American conference in Montevideo, Uruguay. And at that conference, we announced the Good Neighbor Policy. The Good Neighbor Policy says, not only do we renounce Roosevelt Corollary earlier, now we're giving up dollar diplomacy. So what does that mean?
South America is pretty much free. Now.
Yeah, we're not going to be the interfering.
Free from us.
Yeah, we're not going to, we're going to show respect. We're going to treat you as an equal sovereign. Good neighbors.
Until the communists come start
close,
to get over.
Close, yeah. Why in the 1930s? It would be wonderful. As a Democrat who loves FDR, I would love to say that FDR just wanted to make the country look better after all that Republican mistreatment of Latin America, that Democrats are the good foreign policy people. It would be wonderful to say that was the reason. What is?
An ally, maybe?
Against?
The bad guy?
Hitler. Reason one is this. These South American countries were always a little bit rightward tilted to begin with. They enjoyed fascistic types of governments. They enjoyed goose-stepping. When Hitler came to power in 33, they just were gaga, sending in photos for autographs. I mean, there was a real pro-Hitler upsurge feeling in Latin America. And there was also this feeling of, maybe Hitler can help us rescue us from those nasty Americans up north. So, reason one, to prevent our hemispheric friends from drifting into a pro-Axis position.
Because then they'd actually be like fighting close to us.
Hemisphere.
Not an ocean apart.
In case Germany does like a Zimmerman telegram
Yeah. We want to make sure that they're not listening to those kind of telegrams. They're our American friends.
I think Zimmerman's a lot. He could send the new telegram too.
Reason two, better relations with anybody around the world. Latin America included, means during the Depression more what?
Money.
Business. So therefore, the good neighbor policies based on their idea of let's generate friendship with Latin America to provide more economic growth in the 30s and to, down the road, stem off any problems with Nazis in our hemisphere. That is also the basis for number 15. When did the communists take over Russia?
Right before the treaty that they got up over one.
Those two revolutions.
Yeah, 1917. So before World War I's over. Yet our government refused to acknowledge the Soviets as the rightful rulers of Russia.
We haven't got our troops out of Russia yet? We
by 21. By 21. Oh. Yeah. We refused to accept the communists as truly the government of Russia. We're still acting like the Duma or the Tsar or somebody's head of Russia as late as 1933.
So when we talk to Russia, we're not talking to...
We're not talking. We're not doing business with, we're not talking, we're not dealing with Russia.
Closed.
Yeah. So why are we refusing to acknowledge this gigantic nation in the East?
Because they represent undemocratic principles.
Because that would formal... it's like accepting gay marriage. To go way off topic for a second. If you legalize gay marriage, what might that say about gayety?
That it's right.
That it's acceptable. So if you acknowledge the Soviet government, you're acknowledging communism as a viable, legitimate form of government.
Or if you acknowledge Taiwan, you're saying they have a legitimate rebellion.
So that was, and coming out of that ice, that's not the word I'm going to use, coming out of that capitalist laissez-faire 1920s, you can see very much why we did not want to have any proximity of recognizing Marxism. So why in 33 does FDR, no, it's not because FDR is a communist, I get that one all the time. Why does FDR in 1933 acknowledge Russia, extend recognition?
Make more friends.
Against?
Germany.
Because Hitler was threatening Russia more than the West. Hitler badmouthed democracy, but he badmouthed communism even worse. So it always looked like Russia was at more threat than the West.
And they weren't.
And they really were, because that's where the invasion goes. So therefore, we and the Russians may not like each other. We may not have anything in common. They're communists, but the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And just like we're neutralizing South America, we want to neutralize Russia against Germany. And also, same second reason, still in business. Because if we can do some capitalist business with Russia, maybe by 1989 they'll finally become capitalists.
Are we trying to help with China?
And they did.
Is China still communist?
No.
On paper.
They're one party capitalists.
They're really more fascist than communist.
People.
They seem like quasi-capitalist.
We didn't make any deals with Russia about anything.
In the 30s?
Did the Clark Memorandum and the Good Neighbor Policy.
That. After official recognition, business starts to open up, and we start putting investment in there. Although it's very guarded cautious, because a lot of people are afraid of putting a private business into a communist nation.
Which they can nationalize.
What was the USSR's reaction to that? Oh, good, thanks.
We need it too. We don't trust capitalist Americans, but the Germans are a bigger threat, so good relations with the West might protect us in the future.
It won't.
Then we go to 16. In 1934, we renounced the Platt Amendment, except for the Guantanamo part. Why do we renounce the Platt Amendment?
Because it makes us seem more imperialist, and we need Cuba to not go with Hitler.
Yeah, so to stem off that imperialist, look, we're no longer going to defend you.
You have nukes 13 miles off.
Yeah. Like the Good Neighbor Policy, we respect you as an independent sovereign power that's a friend, not a protectorate.
What about... since we're trying to make friends with everybody in the Western Hemisphere, what about, Canada?
We are already on good terms with Canada.
So they're like...
We've been on good terms with Canada since
we
started trying to
work.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. After that little lumberjack mishap.
I guess we've been on good terms with Cuba since we stopped trying to invade them.
Getting there. After Castro passed. But, the rise of Castro to power is now easier to understand, isn't it? Castro came to power in 1959 with a bunch of bad-mouthed and hating American stuff, and it worked.
Because
there was a history. There was a history of and Batista before him.
The dictator that's
a dictator who had allowed all the gangsters and the mafia people to come in and make money. That's Godfather.
And the Americans to have their sugar plantations. Sugar plantation.
Yeah. Tidings McDuffie Act. Sometimes on the test, may not.
Does that mean we renounce the Tidings McDuffie Act?
No. Should be this. Tidings McDuffie should have been number 17, just a separate thing.
Oh, okay.
I think I had space in there and said, hey, let's stick some facts in there while I got space. The Tidings McDuffie Act, if I'm correct, if I'm telling the truth, is moving our territorial government over Philippines from being a complete territorial occupation to treating them more like a dominion nation. They will now have a degree of self-rule. They can elect all their own local legislators. We'll still appoint their governor, but they now have a legislature of Filipinos they elect themselves. So it's in fact, and the Tidings McDuffie Act said by 1945 we'll completely liberate the Philippines.
But what?
By 1945 we'll completely liberate, they'll be completely independent.
Even if they have to militarily liberate them?
Well, it took a year later. It took to 46 to do it.
Well, because there was the whole invasion.
Japan took over for a while. But if had there not been World War II, that would have happened in 45. Now, what's the purpose of the Tidings McDuffie Act?
Well, to prevent a fascist, pro-Japanese uprising in the Philippines.
Again, it's this idea of treating people, treating our neighbors, treating our former colonies, etc., with more equality and respect in order to generate goodwill and business. And also, I think to some degree, there were those who felt like we've got a weight around our neck with the Philippines. Because if Japan invades, we've got to go defend them because they're our territory. In the isolationist 30s, it would be nice to not have as many obligations. So as we move the Philippines slowly towards independence, who knows what will happen later, but it won't be our responsibility anymore. Some of that 17. The 1933 London Economic Conference. This was a meeting of major European nations in America for the purpose of discussing what to do about currency stabilization. Britain, very strong promoter of the gold standard, wanted to make sure that nations do not devaluate their money, that they keep things equal to a dollar of gold is worth a dollar of gold. And if all the major world powers stay that way, the economy should stay strong in the depths of this depression. FDR sent representatives but agreed to nothing because FDR had already planned to devaluate the dollar to fight the depression. That's all I know. If there's not more to know, because I don't know if there is.
Can you kind of relate that to Japanese yen being devaluated in their entry to the auto market?
If I understood it well enough, I could.
Oh, never mind.
It seems like the same theory, yeah. But while we're at this, look at the top of the page. See the Bretton Woods 1944 thing? Mm-hmm. Bretton Woods Conference in New Hampshire in 1944. What's the state of the world in 1944?
World War II.
It's World War II. It's close to the end. We're finally successfully have D-Day succeeded. So we know we're going to win. We still got to slug it out for another hard year, but it looks like now we're going to win. So as we are starting to win, the U.S. government, who has been taking, how can I say this? The U.S. government has been feeding weapons to all our allies. Lindley's program. Almost all the Russian weapons, almost all the British weapons and Chinese weapons are made in American factories. So we're winning World War II not only by fighting, but by supplying all our allies.
Well, Russia still has some of the wrong stuff.
They're making some
the
of the
T-Series things.
But a lot of that stuff's our stuff coming in. And so what we decide, and I think this is admirable, is if we're going to win this war and pay for this war, then when the war is over, from now on, we want to have a central role in money stabilization. And what we want to see is the American dollar, not gold, not silver, the American dollar will be the basis of all other world currencies. All currencies will be based on the value of the dollar. Or you can't have any more Lindleys.
Or you can't what?
Lindleys.
We won't give any more weapons. Fight fascists on your own. So they have to agree.
What did the...
Which means that from 1945 on, our economy is always going to be somewhat safe because all the world's currencies depend on us. That's like what you're doing. I'm all for that.
This was the Bretton Woods?
Mm-hmm. In 1944. Back to 1934, where we were. Reciprocal trade agreements. Congress passes a law that's... Have you ever noticed this? There's no named tariffs after Holly Smoot. There's hardly any talk about tariffs. Why? Because of this right here. Number 18 explains it. In 1934, Congress gives the President the authority through the Reciprocal Trade Agreements law to set individual tariff rates with individual nations as he so wishes. Now, obviously, a President is not going to set a tariff rate that is out of harmony with the rest of Congress and the opposition party. That would be suicide political. So why are they giving the president the authority to make tariff agreements outside of Congress passing individual tariffs?
It was more foreign policy.
Yeah, it's much more efficient. You can negotiate without all the added extra work of Congress a lot more trade agreements with people. Some might argue, well, this is just an example of how big and powerful FDR made the presidency grow. Well, yes, that's true. But when Congress agreed and found it more efficient, we've never turned it over since then. So Bush today makes trade agreements with countries without having to go to Congress for ratification. And it's just come to be accepted practice. Boy, 19's leading into something here. Is 19 true? Yes. Did the depression caused by America lead to the rise of these fascist tyrannical aggressors?
Yes.
You bet. And who are them fascist tyrannical aggressors?
Hitler, Mussolini, well, and the Emperor of Japan isn't really.
So the three nations are?
Japan, Italy, and Germany.
And they're called the?
Axis.
Because Mussolini said we'll draw a line from where to where?
Berlin to Rome.
Now we're on to 22.
We're skipping the march on Rome?
Yeah.
They didn't draw anything to Tokyo?
A transaxle came over in 1939.
Tokyo, Japan, you can just kind of jump on the ride.
Mr. Jones, are we leaving off the 1922
March on Rome? I saw that, yeah. I better do that. Okay, let's get these fascists in power. Let's start off with Mussolini. He's the first in the early 20s, 1922. In fact, he and his group of black shirts decided, let's try to march on Rome and take over, and if they fire upon us, scatter and run away. If they don't, we've got it. And it worked. They just marched on Rome and took over. That's how bad Italy was. Italy was in disarray from 1919 on, when Orlando was unable to get those cities in Yugoslavia that he'd secretly negotiated to get. His government was embarrassed and driven from power, and like 16 different governments came and went between 1919 and 1922. So there wasn't much stability anyway. It was easy for Mussolini to take over. But let's look at what Mussolini believed in. He was the founder of the Fascist Party. We need to explain what fascism believes and how it differs from communism. You know what's the most frustrating thing for me? When assistant principals, we'll use no names, are sometimes exercising heavy authoritarian policies, what do kids always call them? Communists. They call him, he's a communist. No, he's a fascist. You need to understand the difference.
I say Nazi a lot.
Okay, that works. That works for me.
It's true.
We need to explain the difference in philosophy. Now, even though they both use the same tactics, one-party states, secret police, torture camps, etc., their strategies are the same. Their goals are different.
One's equality and the other one's decidedly not equality.
Yeah.
Is that a dictionary over there?
Mm-hmm. No, it's up in there in that wooden podium up there.
Even if by quality they mean they can't produce anything.
Let's start by explaining what communists believe, then we'll come back to fascists. Marxists believe that someday all the working class people of the world, regardless of nationality, Russian, Canadian, Indonesian, American, Mexican, all the working class people will someday rise up and overthrow the business owners, the capitalists, and create a network of workers, organizations,
and committees.
Committees, syndicates, whatever, and that all these working class people who respect each other as working class will never mistreat each other. They'll create a utopian nation, and the final class struggle will have come to be. There's no longer anybody needing to overthrow anybody because working class industrialists will create.
Sounds like an economic Armageddon.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a socialist utopia where everybody's taken care of equally, everybody's cared for by the state.
Until corrupt people get in and start disappearing people.
And we know this, that most communist nations, if not all, have been heavy-handed and have dealt harshly with dissenters and had secret police and torture camps, etc. So that's what we usually think of communists as, not as a utopian of workers. But philosophically, they believe in the union of international brotherhood working class people. Fascists, on the other hand, which Mussolini is the founder of, and Hitler will also be a fascist, and the Japanese will flirt with it. Italian fascism starts off with the belief that we need to have another Roman Empire, that Italy and Rome must rise again in power. And so it's not surprising that what's the imagery they follow. In fact, what is a fasces?
A bundle of rods with an axe.
A what?
Yeah.
A bundle of sticks and rods wound tightly into a firm stick that has an axe handle on the top of it. What's symbolic by this fascism?
Power.
You can break one stick, but when you tie a bunch of sticks together, that's kind of hard.
United we stand, divided we fall.
Used to be on the back.
And we also have the power to take out whoever doesn't believe it.
Back of the dime with the marching guns. And so.
Oh, and that's what the axe is?
Yeah, they have the power to.
So fascist thinking is when you are all united behind the policy, behind the leader, you have a powerful nation which can't be defeated. When you disagree with each other and don't support the policy and dissent, your nation falls apart. So from that already you can get a guess that fascism feels what way about free speech and opposition?
Pretty much all of it. It doesn't exist.
So that's why when you get this kind of stuff from school authorities, they're fascists. More so than they're not trying to create an international brotherhood of working class people. They don't want you to disagree with the sign on the window. That's what they're trying to do. Also, fascists believe in nationalism. That your nation and your race are superior to others. That Germans are superior to everybody else, and the German nation is more important than anyone else.
So how did Germany and Italy get along?
If they both thought they were better than the other.
How did we get along with a bunch of communists in World War II?
We were making money off them.
Oh, so they both secretly wanted to take over the whole entire world just on their own?
I think in the long run, the classic question would have been this. If the fascist Axis powers had won World War II,
they would probably have ended up fighting each other.
Like we did with the Russians.
So
the difference
Germany and Italy
emerged.
Both just turned their attention. So they'll be co-superior and they'll look on Japan as superior.
What about Stalin?
I've got to share this one with you. Yep. Hey, you'll get this one.
If race superiority is important in fascism, let's
build on this a little bit for a second.
Are you going to bring the Robbie Jackford?
Hold on here. If race superiority is significant, Germans are Aryan and a Teutonic superior people, right? Then how would they feel about allying with Japanese yellow people? And I married one, so I'm
saying they wouldn't really like that.
No, they would see them as what?
Inferiors.
Right.
They shouldn't even be connected to our
athlete. So why would Germany make an agreement to fight World War II with the Japanese if they really racially looked down upon them?
It was convenient.
It was convenient. Very, very convenient. And so therefore, Germans actually extended honorary Aryan status to the Japanese during the war.
This is for real?
You are temporarily honorary Aryans while we're fighting the Western powers.
It's not an Onion article.
No, but here's an Onion article, though, that builds on that.
Okay.
This is an article,
honorary white people.
Supposedly, the day that Hitler invaded Poland in 1939.
Hitler neutralizes Polish men.
At the bottom of the page it says, Japan forms alliance with white supremacists in well-thought-out scheme. Isn't that great? But that's the basis of fascism, the belief that your people, your nation, is superior to everyone else. That's why the strong emphasis upon race identity. And not surprising, it's also why Hitler would seize upon castigating which scapegoat people.
Jewish
people, for sure, because they're non-German, non-Aryan, and they threaten the unity of the pure people, master race. If you are superior, let's do hypothetical. Let's say we thought our Anglo-Saxon nation is superior to Mexicans or to Indians or something like that. What would we feel justified in doing?
Taking over their countries.
Having a war with them.
We might feel like moving west and gobbling up their lands is not even wrong. It might even be
what they call jingoism.
Jingoistic manifest destiny.
Good job.
That sounds like I'm America hating again, but to put it into German perspective, the German thinking was we are superior to Slavic people, we are superior to Poles, we are superior to Russians, we're superior to the Baltic Balkan people. Therefore, that justifies what?
Taking over Russia and Poland.
So that's fascism. Fascism is built around this idea of centralized authority around policy. It's also built on the idea that our nation and race is superior to others. No, they don't believe in international brotherhood with other working class people because German workers are racially superior to Polish or American.
Kind of do despise communists.
Yeah, they despise communists because they've got it all upside down wrong. Also, fascism.
Question, where did they justify going to war with Britain and France and other people?
Well, here's one theory. The French are not the same as the British, are they? French are Latin. They're not Anglo-Saxons came from Germany, but the Franks are Latins, so they are inferior. The Italians were useful lackeys until the war is over, by the German perspective. You ever heard of Dunkirk Beach situation?
I read it on newspapers.
Okay, in 1940, Hitler surrounds all the British and French soldiers early in the war. Could have captured almost all the British and French soldiers, and he hesitates. He gives a few days off and lets these people be rescued and taken back to England. Major mistake on Hitler's part, but some people have concluded that the belief was, since the British were Anglo-Saxon Aryan people, he could negotiate a race agreement with these people. You should not be in this war against us. You should be with us because you are of the same racial background. Ludicrous.
Then where does he get off with Operation Sea Lion?
Well, after it's obvious that the British are not going to agree with them, then they become enemies that have to be dealt with. But there was this feeling that we don't want to get too much into war with the British because they are the same racial background as we are. So race, unity of government, and the third aspect of fascism is corporate statism. The promotion of a few rich monopoly corporations, and the workers will be put into unions not for the sake of protecting their business against the corporations, but so corporations can monitor and watch them and make them be good workers. In fact, everybody under fascism is considered a soldier of the state, a soldier of the business you work for.
Unless you own the business, or even if you
own. If you own the business, you get to be the ones that help plan
you get to be the general of the business.
The scheme of everything. But that's fascism. So that's what Mussolini organized in the 20s. As you know, Hitler starts to join the Nazi Party in Germany in the early 20s, and they look up to Mussolini as someone who's come up with a great idea for Germany, too. They write him letters and wish he would come visit, etc. And Mussolini has no time for small fry Germans in the 20s. By the 30s, however, Hitler has grown so powerful it's the other way around. Mussolini now wants to attach himself to the German wagon to stay in power. Are we still just politely listening to me out of courtesy, or are we into this?
Very much.
Okay, do we need...
It's like listening to a really good story.
The can is unlocked. If at any time you need to use so, feel free.
It's definitely more exciting in person.
Than
online.
I need a picture of you to look at.
Still photos.
Yeah.
If what's in stills online there, so...
But you have to get that look. Like someone just says something really, really liberal or conservative. I can't do the look.
So we can go on? Great. Okay, so Mussolini's March on Rome was successful and the fascists take over Italy in the 1920s. Now, if you are superior to someone, you're supposed to be invading them and taking over, right?
Yeah.
That's basic fascist philosophy. So Mussolini's got to find somebody he can beat. And in 1935... Invading out of Italian Somalia, he invades his neighbor to the west, Ethiopia, and takes over.
That was hard.
Ethiopia.
So it's just because of proximity?
Yeah. Ethiopia was the only, it's the only country left that had not been made a European colony. It was the only independent nation of Africa at this time.
Didn't the British try to take over?
Tried, but they didn't succeed to this. In fact, the Italians had lost a famous battle to them in 1896 called the Dawa. Mm. And they've been proud of their independence since then. So the emperor of Ethiopia, a man named Haile Selassie that lived up until like 1975 or 76, Haile Selassie goes to the League of Nations and says, we are a League member. You are all League members. We have been invaded by a League member. It is time for Article 10, the League Covenant, to be put into place.
Yeah,
which would that mean?
That'd be all the other nations coming in invading
him. Another World War.
Did they?
No.
They just placed economic sanctions on Italy. What does an economic sanction mean?
Something that if enforced might be, it sells a little bit more expensive or you can't sell weapons.
It's a cut off of trade, that there'll be no business to be done. Also, supposedly everybody's not going to do business with Italy and then economically that'll pressure Italy to get out.
But then of course the one person that does gets
Yeah, and it wasn't upheld, nobody called it. So what do economic sanctions mean?
Absolutely.
It means
absolutely nothing. I mean, in the long run, it really doesn't work unless it's enforced. How did the UN respond to Saddam Hussein's post-Gulf War 1992-93 military?
You can't buy weapons.
Sanctions.
Except from Russia.
Economic, economic sanctions were placed on Saddam Hussein from 1992 up through 2001.
And Russia still sold that.
And they broke it and got through anyway. So what did Bush claim about the economic sanctions?
They were tigers.
They were useless, and he's probably rebuilding in the face of all this docility of the West. Strong argument?
Yeah.
If it was correct.
If he actually had been doing that.
Which probably was, but it wasn't building up there. So
now, here is something that's of no value to the AP test at all. Haile Selassie, the Lion of Judah,
yeah,
is considered a god and worshipped by what religion?
Rastafarian.
And who are the Rastafarians?
That's how I know that name.
Bob Marley is a famous Rastafarian. What are they known for?
Elven warmth.
Loving
harass.
My brother told me a few weeks ago that he was thinking about becoming a Rastafarian. He's in the 8th grade.
Did I
mention that part?
Because he's so into Haile Selassie, right? He's such a Haile Selassie fan.
Wait, and he goes to Trinity.
There's the look.
That should be a film. The First Amendment. Gotta love it in America. In 1938, Mussolini invades Albania, and those are the only two invasions of fascist Italy.
Wait, who does?
Mussolini.
Oh.
And in 1936, a couple of years earlier, he makes his Rome to Berlin Axis speech, and there, obviously, 1939 is Japan added on. Let's talk Japan, number 24. Quick background check on Japan while your hands rest. Japan was a feudalistic, old-fashioned, closed-to-the-world isolationist nation from 1600, or even before all that, until when?
Perry.
And Perry landed in what year?
1867.
53 and 54.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's right in the middle of the Austin Manifesto and all that.
Which was?
1850.
Cuba. Something about Cuba.
Yeah, if they don't sell us Cuba, we'll have to steal it from Spain.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that's why that was so out of place, because we're talking Civil War sectionalism in the 1850s, and how dare anything else get into the history, like relations.
Oh, yeah, I remember. It's like all Civil War, and then there's this one thing about Matthew Perry.
We get to dust the globe off once a year. So Perry's visit really starts things in Japan changing. By 1868, there is a so-called revolution called the Meiji Restoration. And after the 1860s, Japan wakes up to how far behind the rest of the world it is and needs to modernize. So Japan in the 1870s start to build an industry based on American model.
And they buy all kinds of Gatling guns from the U.S.
A military on the basis of the Prussian or German army. And a parliamentary system on the basis of British democracy. So as we go into the 20th century, here is Japan trying to get caught up in a hurry, a world power, and a democratic republic, trying to be respected as that.
The government of Japan, or like the citizens too, are all down with
the government. Well, here's where I can make a connection. The government is pushing this. Prominent top business owners are going with it. The majority of the Japanese populace is probably still living almost like they were prior to Perry's visit. But the movers and shakers of Japan, and this is kind of, you get some of this feeling in the Last Samurai movie, that the samurais are against this rapid modernization going on, if you see that movie. So Japan's trying to become a world power, a respected republic, an economic power, etc. And in the 20s, they're a fairly liberal government. But with the stock market crash in 29, the silk industry of Japan suffers greatly in the early 30s. Depression hits Japan very, very hard. And the answer that Japanese business persons and military people is abandon democracy and become kind of like Mussolini, become a fascist area. They don't never become officially fascist, but the culture is already ripe for it, that every citizen of Japan is a member of the army of Japan, a member of the nation, loyal, don't disagree, etc. So Japan is tugged by the military and business interests in a fascistic direction in the early 30s. And they are real serious about this invading foreign countries because they are superior. Japan, and I've got some personal experience with Japanese culture, but having been a Buddhist for a long time. And one of the things that has been true about Japan prior to World War II and still lingers even to today, there is a certain degree of racial arrogance among the Japanese towards fellow Asian nations. Now, not as bad now, obviously, but prior to World War II, there was this feeling that Japanese are just culturally superior to Chinese and Filipinos and Koreans, etc.
So that's set up perpetually.
Yeah, there you've got the breeding grounds for it. That if we are superior to Chinese and superior to Koreans, we have the right to their minerals.
That's not just the basis of fascism, that is fascism itself.
Yeah, so even if they weren't card-carrying, saluting Roman-type stuff, black shirt, brown shirt, goose-stepping, in their hearts, they've already embraced fascist principles. And that's the element that takes over Japan in the 1930s, is the military and the business interests come to dominate Japanese government, all during the Depression, promising better jobs and opportunity and pride for the Japanese. Civilian prime ministers try their best to retard and hold back this military takeover, and I think two or even three are assassinated. So after that, they kind of hint, if you want to stay alive, you don't buck up against the military.
Avoid the ice pick at all costs.
Mm-hmm. In 1931, the Japanese military engineered the Mukden Incident of 24. Mukden is a prominent city, maybe even the capital, or Harbin is. I think Mukden is the capital of Manchuria. Where is Manchuria?
Southern part of Russia and the Far East.
This corner of China is Manchuria, the northeastern corner. Why is, and what we haven't talked about, but you'll hear on the notes, is that there was a war between Russia and Japan in 1905 to try to control that area. Who mediated the settlement to it?
T.R.
Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt, Portsmouth Treaty. So Japan's already shown an interest in that area in the earlier part of the time period. The invasion here's what happens. Mukden has a number of prominent Japanese business people living there. A train station blows up mysteriously. Japanese citizens are killed. And the Japanese government claims, we can't let these Chinese terrorists threaten our nationalists anymore.
Let's fight them.
We have to go in and take order and restore order to Manchuria.
Oh, conspiracy.
It was. So the Japanese military moves in, takes over Manchuria, renames the place Manchukuo, which is Japanese for the Nation of Manchus. Takes the last emperor, Henry Puyi, who was of Manchurian descent, and places him supposedly as emperor of Manchukuo, but he's really a puppet ruler under Japanese troops.
And they enslave everyone.
Have you ever seen The Last Emperor?
Yeah, this is very much part of it. The Last Emperor is great. So let's think for a second, what's happened? What's the consequences? The Japanese have essentially taken over a big portion of China. League of Nations sends something called the Lytton Commission to investigate. In 1933, took their time.
To investigate
what's happened. And the Lytton Commission comes back, reluctant to say so, but with the conclusion is that the Manchurian people didn't really want this. Japan is just engaged in imperialism and should leave. What's Japan's reaction?
They leave.
Finger.
Yeah. And they leave. That's pretty much it. And they quit the League of Nations, but they don't leave Manchuria.
Only build more ships, too.
And they renounce the five-power treaty limits and start building up military hardware. Now, at that point in time, right then and there, America should be thinking...
Yeah, that should be red flag.
But what's happened to the open door policy?
It's gone.
And so we sit there and warn them for like 2 or 3 years and then cut off the royal hand.
Yeah, terribly violated. The open door policy is violated. And the ship building is an illustration of this is Japan moving out. There should have been some action taken in 1932, 33 about this. Why wasn't there?
You said Japan was
Stimson Doctrine. Stimson Doctrine?
Well, before we get to the Stimson Doctrine, what might be the reason that we're not focused on Japan and Manchuria?
Isolationist.
Depression. The isolation depression. We can't worry about going to the moon. We've got Vietnam and Watergate to worry about. Isolationism is growing, as we said earlier, because of the Depression. We don't want to get dragged into another world war on the other side of the ocean in China. Besides, who makes all the money off of China anyway? Business interests, who are probably good buddies with the merchants of death.
The Arsenal of Democracy.
Yeah. So therefore, Japan, but we do issue in 1932 the Stimson Doctrine. Stimson was an undersecretary of state for the Hoover administration. No, he's secretary of state, forgive me. And Henry Stimson's doctrine says, we do not recognize Japanese gains in the Pacific. We do not recognize Japanese aggression in the Pacific. That's a double meaning. Traditionally, when you recognize a government, what does that mean?
You send them an ambassador, you open up your embassy, you begin to dialogue with them.
If you refuse recognition, it means what?
You just ignore their existence.
Yeah, they're not legitimate, they're not real. In this case, it has a double meaning. Refusing to recognize can mean we will not officially accept you as the true government of Manchuria, but it can also mean we refuse to even see you did it. Violation of the open door policy? Don't see that going on. That's really what it meant. The Stimson Doctrine means we're not going to do anything about it. And that's a strong signal to Japan.
Take over more.
And 26, we've already kind of dealt with here. What we see going in Japan is the growth of a proto-fascist military-industrial complex buildup taking over Asia. In fact, Japan even explained what they were doing through this policy. The Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Plan.
Or our version, the Greater Central American Co-Prosperity Plan.
Pretty similar. In fact, let me translate the Greater East Asian Co-Prosperity Plan. It's going to be sarcastic, but accurate. Hey, fellow Asians, you don't need to be conquered by whiteys. Superior Japanese will do it for them.
See that, like, on the radio.
That's pretty much what it meant was, is that we will conquer and take care of Asia and liberate you from the dangers of European imperialism.
At the same time enslaving you and testing chemical weapons on you.
Because we like this whole entire fashion.
And that's what that meant. This phrase here, military-industrial complex, let's spend a few seconds on this. Where have you heard it before, maybe, and what does it mean?
It's the
Eisenhower.
Oh, yeah.
And what does it mean?
The conglomeration of the military and the industry to produce weapons and to control the government of the country.
So if you invade an area where there's lots of rich minerals, you can build more industrial production, which
and
might mean more weapons.
And then the industrial will build more weapons, and with those, they'll take over more areas that have resources.
Reminds me of something in Quizzville. I hate to waste time on Quizzville, but years ago we were talking about why did we hold so many tournaments and invite so many nations. So many schools. How many more schools can we get in the tournament? How many more tournaments can we hold? Why? Because we needed to make more and more money. More and more money.
Hold more.
Why did we need more and more money?
Hold more tournaments.
To go play in more tournaments. To afford all the tournaments. And Sean Staniford, of the 2001 team, said it reminded him of the thing about the Vikings. Why did the Vikings invade villages and conquer and take over? To loot and pillage to get the resources. Why? So they can invade more villages and loot and pillage. So that's the military-industrial complex. If you have a military that is constantly conquering foreign lands in order to get more resources for industry to make more weapons so they can make more money, this massive influence of a growing military and a growing industry, how does that sit with democracy?
It doesn't.
It's very much a threat to it. That's what happened in Japan. When it comes to the phrase military-industrial complex, it's most memorable coming from whom, Yaron? Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. Well, let's think about Eisenhower for a second. Eisenhower, what's his resume?
He was Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in Europe, planner of D-Day.
A Heavenly Star General.
Impossible.
So he's got some credentials as a military dude, right?
And he was, was that under NATO,
nobody.
The original Supreme Allied Commander?
He was the NATO Commander of Europe after World War II and President of Columbia University, and then he even became President of the United States.
For a little while there.
Slipped down on that last part there.
He kind of appointed Earl Warren.
Yes. Yeah. So Eisenhower had been more involved and more knowing about what goes on in the military than anybody. I mean, he'd been there. He'd been from top to bottom to top on this whole thing. So when he left office as a president in 1961, in the depths of the Cold War, for sure, you might have thought, here an old military winner of World War II, conservative Republican president, in the time of the Cold War, would be the leading charger of got to fear the Russians, got to build up the military. Instead, instead, he gives a speech, his farewell address. There's two famous farewell addresses. There's Washington and his. And in that he says, America, every dollar spent on weapons is food and medicine taken out of mouths of the poor. Beware of the military-industrial complex.
And then we go into the 60s and 70s, and we build up the military-industrial complex.
But what does that tell you? I mean, here's a military dude himself warning people.
It must be really bad.
Yeah, it's like one of the Klan members saying, is the Klan racist? Hey, I'm a Klan member. Yes, we are. I think, I mean, when one of their own tells it like it is. So that's where the military-industrial complex usually gets its is this kind of a Halliburton Iraq thing?
Or a TRW missile building thing?
27. In 1937, an American gunboat, the Panay, was sailing along on the Yangtze River.
Mine's own business.
A business that was mine. American gunboats over China. And it's attacked by Japanese planes and sunk. Now, this probably would make more sense had I already announced that number 28 had occurred. But before we get to number 28, what do you think American public reaction to that was?
Instantaneous reaction, like...
Like, we got to go to war and defend America.
No.
What, Japan's there?
We were stupid enough to be there. Why should we have been there?
The majority of Americans said it was crazy for us to be where we don't belong. We're going to get dragged into wars. We should pass legislation making it to where we can't send our military hardware in other places. That's how isolationist we were in the 30s. So while Japan apologized for the action, when they saw
how can you apologize for sinking a ship delivery?
You have to do that
what
stuff.
Like the Israelis,
you know, technically apologize for an afternoon.
Like the Germans did.
You've got to do that stuff.
What'd you say? I missed.
After saying nappy headed, etc., can you apologize?
Well, you can't.
I'm all right about that.
I'm going to get fired.
Is it coming out?
Sorry,
yeah. After you shoot people on an American boat, you can apologize if you're the Israelis.
Well, yeah. Japan apologized, but also Japan noticed that the lack of forceful reaction by the U.S. government sent what signal?
Don't keep doing it.
Yeah, that the open door policy is long gone dead. We have no fear of the Americans in China. We can move in our co-prosperity plans and not have to worry at all about American resistance. This is the examples of isolationism. And in 1937, that same year, I'm not sure if it's before or after the attack, full-scale war breaks out in the Pacific. When Chinese forces and Japanese forces fire upon each other at the border of Manchuria at the Marco Polo Bridge. So if you're charting when did World War II start in the Pacific, it starts here in 1937. Won't start in Europe till 39. I've been waiting for the main star to appear on stage, the King Kong and Chains himself, and here it is, Hitler in Germany, number 29.
The King Kong and Chains. Have you seen that new movie that's like 50,000 hours long?
The new King Kong?
Mm-hmm.
You know the original King Kong and Citizen Kane was on TV this morning? On Channel 66.
What's Channel 66?
TBS? TCM. Turner Classic.
MASH comes on one of those really high channels a lot on the weekday nights.
186. with Walker, Texas Rangers.
Yes, that's it. It's like the Hallmark Channel or something.
I'm on 12. I've never seen
Doesn't that. Everybody love Walker, Texas Rangers?
No.
Okay, thank you. I know why. They're too busy watching Star Trek for Walker.
Even though it only comes on now at 1 a.m. on G4 after Dish Network dropped the spike and all that.
Number 29. Okay, it says Germany-failure of Weimar Republic. Why did it fail?
Because of the
Because of the problems of paying back the war debts mixed with bad problems in the 20s and then crushed by the depression of the 30s. So that's what's going to occur to the Weimar Republic as 20s turn to 30s. Let's see how Hitler and the Nazi Party play a role in this in number 30. Adolf Hitler, an Austrian-born individual, moves to Germany because he thinks Germany is superior to Austria, joins the German military, fights in World War I, suffers a poisonous gas attack, not enough, sadly. Survives. Oh, he was mean to Hitler.
poisonous gas thing.
You didn't? Mm-hmm.
I did.
Survives. At the close of the war, you know, Germany lost, but think for a second. Where was Germany when where strategically was for Germany's forces when the war ended?
When it ended?
When they surrendered.
Russia?
They were in France. They were inside France. Yeah. They were never thrown back into their own German nation. Now, the reasons they had to surrender was because they had run out of resources, people were starving, it was falling apart, and within weeks they would have been thrown back into Germany deep if they hadn't surrendered. But it's easy years later to look back and say, what? We were all over those Viet Cong. What happened? We could have won this thing. It's easy to reinvent the history according to what you think should have been going on or could have been going on. And it was common for right-wing extremists in Germany to say, we weren't really losing World War I. We just gave up because we were stabbed in the back by non-German elements at home. Who?
Jews.
Jews, gypsies, communists, homosexuals, all those non-Aryan folk. They all sabotaged the government. We could have won. That's the mantras of the Nazi Party in 1919. Hitler joins in 1919, quickly rises to become head of the party, is enamored with the Mussolini's fascistic symbolism and regalia. So they wear black shirts and brown shirts like the fascists. They do their Roman salute. They follow much of the principles and ideas. And what the Nazi Party starts to do is to try to generate support by saying, we Germans are superior people. We should have been winning World War I. We got stabbed in the back by elements at home. Versailles was a mistake. In fact, Versailles can be ignored, Germany can rise again powerfully, and no one will stop us. Now, to the lunatic fringe extreme, that's pretty popular stuff in the 20s, but the majority of Germans just see that as like crazy Klansmen. And in 1923, Hitler tries something very abortive and too early. He tries to take over Bavaria in what's called the Beer Hall Putsch. This is number 21. My family and I went to visit Europe in 2000, and one of the stops on the bus tour was the beer hall, Hofbräu Beer Hall in Munich, where this uprising started, and where the Nazi Party first planned their activities. And having seen pictures of it, their meetings in the 20s and 30s, it was really creepy and spooky to look at the arched areas of the wood grain. I mean, there it was, that's where Devil himself, you know, arose in power.
Did you smell the sulfur?
It felt like that. Huh? And the beer was good and plentiful, and pretty soon we consumed quite a bit. And before I knew it, my son and I were, without self-restraint, toasting Hitler and the Nazis with F this and F that and getting louder and louder. And my wife was giving me the weirdest look, you know, and I looked around, and all of a sudden I noticed here were all these very master race Anglo-looking meh skinhead people staring at me and the brown family members, and we shut up and got out. That's my memory of Munich with the beer hall putsch. He failed. He was put in jail and spent 6 months in jail dictating to one of his underlings, Rudolf Hess, Mein Kampf.
How do you spend 6 months in jail for treason?
Seems like it ought to be more than that.
Because it's like the weakest part of history.
It's southern Germany. It's in the north of Austria. Yeah. Mein Kampf translates as what? Or my battle. And what are some of the things the book contain? That's it. Yep. That we in the party will take over Germany. Tide will turn, we'll be listened to, we'll be popular, our ideas will sell, we'll unite all Aryan people, we'll eliminate the vermin of the world, Jews, and take over and spread everything. So everything he ended up trying to do was already in Mein Kampf. Why didn't people read that ahead of time and stop Saddam Hussein?
Because we were still in
isolation.
And if you read the book of every crackpot in the world, you'd have a lot of people to chase down and worry about.
That's true.
Which ones are going to actually become Hitler?
No one named Hitler.
Well, the Depression in number 32, the American Depression, has a major impact on German politics. In the 20s, the Nazis were fools. But in 1932, they won a plurality, not majority, but a plurality of the seats in the German Reichstag or parliament. What does the plurality mean?
Over the biggest faction.
Yeah. And so usually in parliamentary elections where there's multiple parties, not just two, if there's three or four or five parties, how is anything done?
Well, are you talking about an election of executive offices?
As well as policies and laws.
Well, the plurality will elect a nominate the prime minister like Tony Blair for the Labour Party one then.
Well, yeah, but say for example you have Christian Democrats and Green Party and Socialists and Communist Party and Labour Party. And
well, to pass anything you gotta have a majority.
You have to have people working together temporarily through coalitions. And so when coalitions are struck, people will often work with a party they don't identify with to get common cause done. The Nazis were masterful at creating coalitions with all the other parties to get their policies passed. So that's where the Nazi party moves. They're not in the majority, but they're in enough of a plurality position to start passing things that improve their lot and control over German government. Also, the president of Germany, I think his name is Paul. Is that correct? Paul von Hindenburg? Mm-hmm. Somebody von Hindenburg.
No.
Like the blimp?
Yeah.
He was actually like a blimp.
Is pressured. And not that you need to write this down, but in parliamentary systems, kind of like there's the prime minister and the queen, or in other nations there's the prime minister, a chancellor, and there's a president. The prime minister or the premier is the person who's really in the parliament getting things done. And these other people are kind of like ceremonial figureheads who are like retired, emeritus, used to be a chancellor themselves type person.
Hindenburg, or the queen.
Yeah. Hindenburg was one of those. Hero of World War One military. And he was asked to persuade the sitting German chancellor, von Papen, to resign so Hitler could be appointed in his place. Knowing how much the military and the corporate interests of Germany liked the Nazis and thought they could use the Nazis to their advantage, Hindenburg was pressured to do that. So he got the sitting chancellor to resign, appointed Hitler as replacement, then a year later died. And with the only executive figure being Hitler, and with a now controlling almost majority of parliament, they quickly passed laws to change the system so that the Nazi party could dictate and that democracy disappeared. The Weimar government's just overturned and turned into a fascist government in the 30s.
The bloodless revolution.
It's innocent. Well, it's not bloodless for all.
Well, some people die of natural causes.
So 31 takes place. There's a steady erosion of civil liberties. Democracy disappears into a one-party dictatorship. There is definitely state-planned economic growth. The 30s are economic good times for the Russians, for the Germans, or the latter 30s are. So when the rest of the world is suffering economic decline and problems, Germany is growing economically. A lot of it's government spending military jobs, but it's still growing.
And that's also where they start building the Autobahn.
The Autobahn, the Volkswagens, tanks, missiles, Messerschmitt. Economic upsurge time. It's also, surprisingly, better times economically for the Russians, too, because of planned state economies. And the world starts to wonder, is free market capitalism a failure? Are these planned government-run economies, be they fascist or Soviet, the way of the future? And that figures that figures into the thinking of the New Deal in the 30s. To what degree are we going to let too much government dictate growth in America?
When was Brave New World published?
1940-something.
Oh.
Well, they are fascists, so they have to take over people, right? Non-German people. And as it says in 33, much of the philosophy of German fascism is built around anti-Semitism and Lebensraum. What is anti-Semitism?
Anti-Jew.
Mm-hmm.
What's
the Jew? Lebensraum?
Yeah.
Means living space.
Take over territory.
Oh.
If German people are growing beyond the size of their borders,
okay,
and they're superior people, much superior to those Slavic Poles with all those wheat fields over there.
This is the same idea as like...
Shouldn't New Mexico be part of...
This is the same idea as the justification for Germany in World War One, because there's German people living there, kind of?
That's the post-World War One thing. That's what's going to happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
You need to go over here now.
So Hitler is in 1934 and 35, starts to test the resolve of the Versailles Allies by first building a military beyond Versailles limits. No discipline. He gets away with it. Next, moves weapons west of the Rhine River. No discipline. Gets away with it. So after 1936, Hitler realizes that the same thing Japan realized in Manchuria and the same thing that Ethiopia...
League of Nations sucks.
The League of Nations aren't going to do anything about it. That these fascist powers are going to be able to flex their muscles.
They realize that the Articles of Confederation is powerless.
Good comparison. Here is one of the thinkings of the Allies, the British and the French. Germany was so mistreated and done wrong in Versailles that maybe by looking the other way on this stuff, it kind of restores balance. You know, Hitler's a nasty fellow, but if he just brings pride to the country and helps their economy grow, and they feel like they can get past the injuries of Versailles, then maybe there was a little too much tough treatment in Versailles, so we'll let that go. Is that kind of like if we let Japan build up their ships? They'll feel good again and be respected.
We'll keep them from taking over something by letting them build up their military.
So that way of thought, of letting potential enemies grow a little so they'll be happy and behave themselves, what did that result in World War II?
Because once they grow a little bit, they don't feel happy, they feel ambitious.
So,
if you were George Bush and you grew up and became of age in the post-World War II Cold War period, how might you interpret letting dangerous states build nukes?
That's how you lose. So
yeah. So
yeah, but you do give Saddam the same weapons you got Iran.
Yeah. So really, the thing about Bush is that I think he's misjudged the world and made mistakes. But I can sure see historically where he's drawn his conclusions. Even if wrong, I can see what history he's working from. And maybe I'm wrong. 35 is so true. French, British, American passivity causes fascist aggression. And look at 36, right where we were before. So now we have a better feel for what's going on here in regards to what's happening in the world while we're being so isolated. One might make this statement. We shouldn't have been so hot to trot in World War I and join. But we did. Looking back, we wished we hadn't. So when we should have been hot to trot in the 30s, we weren't. That might be a theme I would quote from. We talked about the Neutrality Act. And number 38, in 1938, in Chicago, President Roosevelt made a speech in which he said, the fascist powers, the Axis powers, are like a disease. And let's say, for example, we had... an outbreak of cholera in the social studies building, but it hasn't reached the main building yet. How do you protect the main building?
You shut it off.
It's called a?
Quarantine.
So that's what FDR said. We need to quarantine the Axis powers so they go no further in endangering the world.
Containment. So just leave them alone?
Containment. Good parallel. Let's talk about that, for example. George F. Kennan, who some of you wrote an essay about last week, the main reason Kennan is remembered is as a diplomat to Russia in 1948 and 49, and as a diplomat to Russia, he came back and told Truman, the Russians truly are a great threat that are trying to take over Western Europe. We need to contain the growth of Soviet communism.
Because if you contain communism to its current boundaries, it'll eventually collapse in on itself. Mm-hmm. And it does.
And that was the military policy of the 40s that Truman adopted, the containment policy by Kennan. So in essence, earlier here, this is what FDR is saying. We need a containment, or as he called it, a quarantine policy against the fascists. Well, how are you going to quarantine fascists?
Keep them from taking over more land.
But what do you got to do to do it?
You got to fight them.
Does the American public want that?
Fight them.
No.
Terrible reaction, American public. Does FDR think he's going to drag us into war? He is out of step with his public.
But he does plan on dragging us in.
Famous man, what was it? I'm not going to commit American boys to fight in foreign wars. And when the war happens, what's his explanation there?
Not
a foreign war anymore. In fact, one of the smoothest things that FDR did was after we wanted to try to help give support to Britain, we declared Greenland within the Western Hemisphere so that we could establish naval activity up in Greenland. Declared officially part of North America. Greenland is North America.
We could that way you protect shipping from
the... So it used to be considered part of Europe. But once it's considered part of the Western Hemisphere, then we're not involved in...
And then you can put your anti-sub ships up there and fight the German wolf packs.
So, anybody see this cartoon last week? It took me a while to figure it out. I'm slow. There was a cartoon of all these faces looking one direction. And if you look at it, and it says, mood of the American public. And all these people looking in one direction, and I was thinking, what's this mean? And you look real close, you see in the midst of all those faces is Bush's face looking the other way. Is that how FDR felt in 1938?
Probably.
Then I don't think Bush is going to
who
be
was wrong? I was going to say, who was right, who was wrong?
FDR was right.
Was FDR wrong?
No.
The American public was wrong, right? How about now?
I think the American public was
wrong.
Trying to give Bush a little chance, though.
These pictures of
well, unless North Korea starts invading people, they might be kind of right.
Yeah, we need
it's to not like
that.
What
are you going to hang that Bush picture
of? Well, you heard my explanation why I don't have one.
They discontinued.
The company went broke during the Bush years. It's
really?
Sold it. I'm not saying it's any connection.
Empty. That's hilarious.
I hope you get one
more, though. That's why you gave them to me.
Here's something that complicates the issue, but it's probably useful to know for this good heritage. Between this is number 39. Between 1936 and 1939, Spain engages in a civil war. Starts in North Africa, Morocco. Francisco Franco, a sergeant in the Spanish military, starts the rebellion. He is openly pro-fascist, right wing. As his revolution succeeds, or his rebellion proceeds. He gains visible support from Mussolini and Hitler, who send him tanks, soldiers, and dive bombers. And with the help of...
Because they want another fascist buddy?
With the help of Germany and Italy, they overthrow the government of Spain.
Yeah, don't you have the Spanish Civil War with all other countries coming in?
Good question.
People from the other countries.
Did anybody... Okay, no. Germans and Italians officially, as governments, helped Franco. Did anybody officially help the Spanish government?
No, you had American writers and stuff.
Yeah, okay. First of all, a bunch of volunteers called the Lincoln Brigade with Hemingway and Dos Passos and others, they get involved in this. Have you ever seen For Whom the Bell Tolls, the movie? That's a Hemingway book about the Spanish
government. The predecessor to the KGB kind of was running around trying to kill Orwell, too.
Well... The only government that came to the help of the Spanish government are the Soviets. The Soviets gave official aid to the Spanish government, but the British, the French, the Americans stay noticeably out of it, and what happens is the fascists win.
Did they really stay out of it? Or?
Well, as he pointed out, some volunteer efforts from literary writers and dancers, but there's no government, not at all.
So there's like
the
writers
table
government?
No, there will be, actually, good point. It would have been a violation of the neutrality laws for them to help Spain, but you are right. There was, FDR knew about, looked the other way, and did not prosecute people who helped China during this time period violating the neutrality laws. But
wouldn't this be like a quarantine thing and we
should have been
quarantined?
Should have been. Why weren't we?
Because we were isolation.
We're still in the show.
World War One was a big mistake and we got a depression to worry about and the merchants of death tricked us into something.
Isn't this kind of where Orwell, though, got
George
his anti-communist stance? Is this where Orwell got his anti-communist stance with Russia trying to kill him during the whole time?
I think so, yeah. But if you were Russian and you tried to help stop the fascists in Spain and failed and you saw that the Western democracies didn't do diddly squat about it,
you'd be kind
of
pissed.
And frightened and scared. So this,
well, they're coming to you now.
So now the Stalin and the Russians are thinking, if the Germans invade eastward, who will come to our aid?
No one.
America will, because they did that. They did the acknowledging us.
Well, we acknowledge them to make money, but I don't think we're in 1933 anymore.
There was no defense
there.
Back. We might loan
you
them
guys
some
are a country. We're going to fight for you.
They wanted France to help them, right? But they
so look at number 42. The 42 always touches me pretty deeply. Are you familiar with the artwork where Santa Claus is drinking the Coca-Cola and the sleigh is New England coming at Christmas time? And you know who the artist is at those kind of works?
Warhol.
Norman Rockwell?
Yeah, Rockwell.
You've seen Rockwell portraits. It's usually down Holmesy life of America, folksy type 30s, 40s
baseball.
Imagery. Yeah, baseball and the innocent child and the doctor taking care of the family.
The poor freedom.
All right. Of the portraits that Norman Rockwell has painted, the most famous are the Four Freedoms. And the Four Freedoms are freedom of speech, Freedom of Worship, Freedom from Fear, the book by David Kennedy that's out. Freedom from what? And in the Rockwell portraits, Freedom from What shows people all getting a turkey dinner at Thanksgiving, sitting down to eat. Freedom of Worship shows them in church praying. Freedom from of Speech is they're in a town meeting, having local democracy take place.
I've seen that one too.
Yeah, and of Fear from Fear is parents looking at a child who's tucked into bed safe-like.
Didn't they use that one in the propaganda?
Well, think about it a second. If you don't know anything more than that, and you know that these paintings came out in 1940, what would the implication be?
A change in U.S. society that's less isolationist? Well,
maybe. I'm thinking more, here we are, a safe, comfortable, just, fair nation, free from all the rest of the world going up in flames, but we're safe here.
That's all 1941.
Well, yeah, that's the impression that the portraits give, and that's what is believed. Truth is this. The Four Freedoms, before they were portraits, were a speech by FDR. A speech in 1940 in which he said, yes, we have these freedoms, but the rest of the world is losing theirs, and we will probably lose ours too unless what?
We do something. Get in the war.
And how's that felt? How's that reacted?
Boo.
Yeah.
You warmonger. You're going to drag us back into war. So every time FDR gets close to or even flirts with the idea of helping the victims of fascism, public opinion drives him back quiet again.
How did he stay in good favor with the public for so long?
Ending the Depression.
Well, ending the Depression got him reelected twice, 36 and 40. But I think this is probably true too. I think Americans, community by community, begin to figure it out. Maybe we can't stay out of this. Maybe the Nazis are a threat. And maybe Dr. New Deal can be Dr. Win the War. I think it's called. FDR is so cool. March of 38. Are we okay? Are we ready for some fascist aggression here?
Let's go.
My favorite.
Hitler, crafty individual, draws upon an SOB. Balance out that statement. Hitler looks at the 14 points and says, what's the basis of much of the Wilsonian desire to create new nations?
We all should self-determine itself.
That people should be lumped together how?
Self-determination.
Yeah, as
racial.
Common race, common language, common religion.
Take a roster.
Yeah, the Czechs ought to have a Czechoslovakia, Poles ought to have a Poland, etc. Well, shouldn't Germans be able to be together? Shouldn't German people who are all spread apart be able to have self-determination together?
Sure.
Like those Austrians next door.
No.
Where I was born, by the way. Those Austrians. Hitler said that.
Okay.
Not me, I'm not born Austrian. Austrians speak German. They have a heritage like Germany that goes back to the Holy Roman Empire. The same culture, same ethnicity, same religion. Austrians are essentially Germans, and there has been a movement for quite some time called Anschluss, which was a desire for union of the two nations. We should honor the wishes of the Anschlussers.
So it was Wilson that started all this.
That's what he's claiming justifies it.
The whole World War II.
So March of 1938, Hitler starts making very overt demands, saying we want to annex and Anschluss Austria because Austrians want it. Well, there was actually a pretty strong, vigorous Nazi party movement in Austria, but the majority of Austrians did not want to be annexed. And the Prime Minister, whose name you don't have to remember, and I don't think I can even say anymore. Schuschnigg? Yeah, somebody Schuschnigg.
Schuschnigg.
S-H-U-S-S-N-I-G. Was called to meet with Hitler, and Hitler just made it clear to him, you can either agree to the Anschluss and become happily part of Germany, or I'll kill you and take over anyway. So, no opposition. And with no opposition, Hitler's troops march in and peacefully annex Austria in September or March of 1938. That shocked the world. But it wasn't the first of things going on. You know, the war in China is already going on, and Albania's been invaded now after Ethiopia. And we're still isolationists, and so are the Western allies unwilling to move. This does kind of start shocking Britain and France.
Hitler met with the Austrian. What was he? The minister? Prime minister? Or what?
The prime minister, yeah. But there was still this excuse for Britain and France. Well, he is right. They are Germans. And Germany was kind of done down in Versailles. And,
you
know, maybe now they've got a bunch of happy Germans together. That'll be the end. See, we have the 2020 hindsight to look back and see that what happened in World War II. But at the time, during still fighting the Depression after World War I, did the Allies
want to... He just took over a whole entire different country, though.
He combined German-speaking people.
Yeah, but then there was this imaginary line, and he went like this to over parents.
Letter, yeah. Well, so I think there is this kind of uneasiness of, do we really want to start a war over this?
Was there any uneasiness, like, why don't we talk to some Austrian people and see if this was...
No, then you might find out they really need help.
Oh, better not do that.
So there's no like League of Nations like invested.
League of Nations dies in 1939. It's voting. Yeah, it's falling apart by then. 6 months later, number 44, September of 1938, Hitler starts to make comments about the Sudetenland area.
This place no longer exists.
Oh, you mean today?
Or is it called something else now?
I think it still exists.
Well, let's work from our Versailles knowledge. Here's the map prior to Versailles, right? Uh-huh. Created out of Austria, there's a lot of different places, but in the northern part of Austria-Hungary was Czechoslovakia, right? Newly created nation. This area of Czechoslovakia, where it borders Germany, mm-hmm. is called the Sudetenland or Sudeten region.
Okay.
That area is extremely rich in minerals for industrial production, very mountainous. It also had about 40% German-speaking people living in it because they had one time been part of Austria there.
It's united.
So Hitler argues, he goes, the people in Sudeten area want to be part of Germany. And the German-speaking people unite. Well, the Czech government said, not so fast. We're not going to cave like Austria. We'll go to war with you if necessary. And the Czech army was the largest army on the continent after Germany. And so when the Czechs also say, not only will our army go to war, but our Versailles, League of Nations, Allies, Britain, and France will be right there with us. to which Chamberlain said, just a minute, let's talk about this for a second. And so therefore they held a conference in Munich, Germany, in item 45, to discuss the Sudeten crisis.
I think you're going to need the Onion article.
Is there one related to that? I have one. So at the
I think it's this conference, maybe another conference.
At Munich, Germany, Neville Chamberlain represents Britain. Mussolini represents Italy. Hitler represents Germany, and Edward Daladier is the French representative.
There's no Czech.
You're the, one of the few that ever catches that. I often will say what nations are missing, and people go Russia, America, etc. Hardly does anybody ever think of that.
Isn't it about Czechoslovakia?
Well, I'd say this. If four of my neighbors got together to discuss my backyard and I'm not at the meeting, I'm not so sure I'm going to be counting on having the backyard after the meeting.
Exactly.
Well, you made the mistake of living in the Covenant area.
Yeah, but that's kind of the... Did you find it? Oh, yeah, let me finish the story and then I'll be able to use that one. And so what happens at this conference is Chamberlain says to Hitler, if we allow you to have this grab, if we let you take Sudeten, will you promise to ask for no more land?
Of course.
Well,
if we let you have their country.
Hitler had already had planned to be told he couldn't have it and have to back down. And when he noticed how quickly Chamberlain acquiesced, he was really surprised that the... You know, buoyed by all this.
Well, of course, he still has the biggest army now in Europe, though.
Yeah, but he figured that this would be the stopping point. And when he realized Chamberlain was willing to cave so quickly, he said, yes, I promise that's it, the last of my land grabs.
Had he said, you can't do this, what would Hitler have done? He would have just done it.
Hitler was not willing to go to war at that point over it. That's what his own memoir showed.
The man was the biggest army, but
he would have just gone to the land France combined.
Many say that seeing Chamberlain cave at that point sent the signal to him that there's no need to ever whimper anymore. Not that he whimpered then either, but that there was no need to go cautious, that there's nothing to stop him. Chamberlain comes back to Britain. Newspaper reporters say to him, how'd he go? He brags as he gets off the plane, for the second time in this century I bring peace in our time, meaning the first time being World War I.
Yeah.
And that's why this Onion article says here as he's getting off the plane.
Says
Chamberlain returns from meeting with Hitler promising London laid waste in our time. This Onion book is so good.
It's a book?
Yeah, it's a book, Our Dumb Century.
Don't they do that?
They do the whole 20th century and things like that.
How big is that book?
Not very big. Yeah.
Really? Where'd you get it?
San Francisco, but you can get it anywhere.
For that book,
because
that book's
going
to be... You can also subscribe to the...
yeah, it'd be the greatest, like, bathroom.
Oh, it's... Once you've taken the AP course...
I think that's the second time I've
you get the Onion book.
Yeah, but they do have this series. Well, it's like collector mixes
extra bathroom
this
books.
Action by Chamberlain of giving in to Hitler, and it's the same pattern I've been talking about. If you let somebody have it, they'll feel
this
respected and equal.
Really
and
happening.
This is called appeasement.
And this is the beginning of the term appeasement, isn't it?
Yeah, the use of the term appeasement. You can't appease dictators. You can't appease bullies. We saw that with letting Japan do what they did in the Pacific. We saw that with Hitler here. The appeasement thing always failed, or at least that's the lesson we're getting here. So now that's why you can probably understand why is Bush calling Democrats appeasers?
Because you can pay Alaric until he invades the Deathly Section.
Same reason he's saying...
Because he's trying to say that it's the same.
Yeah, he's saying that Democrats trying to set a timetable in 2008 to get out of Iraq means we'll just leave, Iraq will fall to the Al-Qaeda terrorists, and we'll have appeased the Islamo-fascists.
Of course, he's kind of blaming his own country, people.
He's blaming the opposition party.
Yeah. Well, if they're stabbing America in the back like communists,
they are
homosexual.
So why was Czechoslovakia not present at the meeting?
Because I think
it was
because the plans were clear to give it to him. Hitler didn't want him there for sure, and when the British and French didn't demand they be there, that showed where they were going.
Were they informed that there was going to be a Munich conference?
They may have been informed of the results by the German troops coming over the border.
Yeah, were they prepared? Just, I mean, they said they were going to fight Germany. So.
People no longer need your services as a coach in the newspaper after somebody else is hired, that thing.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of...
We no longer need your country.
And as I put in number 45, can you see later stuff during the Cold War?
Go, Matt, go.
Anybody up for a pit stop?
Go, Matt, go.
Finish this sentence and we will. And before we go for pit stop, though, let's make plans of how we will come back. Because this is where you lose people. Hunger and bladders start to wear on resolves there. Will we come back?
In 10 minutes.
I'm going right
10 minutes is not enough time to go
right back.
I'll open both doors so we can all... We could even go by gender. Chicks here, dudes over there.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. But could we have a long enough pit stop to go have a call?
I'm for that if you come back. We're getting stuff done. We're making a five, right?
Yeah.
We got through almost
don't let the harlots out there keep your five from happening.
I think that if the test was on only stuff in the 20th century, I would have really...
That guy on the tape, too.
There's only a reception in the 20th century, just about everyone's next time watching this.